This podcast is a member of the Place to Be Nation family. Visit us at placetobenation.com, the only place to be in your pop culture world.
Yeah, Frank here, he's got his own billiard room.
Yes, it's what do you call it, Kramer?
The billiard room.
No.
The name.
The billiard. Not billiard. What? Not the billiards. It was... Come on, Rudy. What? Come on. We call it the
place to
be. The place to be. Yes, it's the place to be.
Then I shall be there.
This is the place to be here tonight.
Time to play the game.
Party people in the place to be. Uh-huh. It's about that time.
Place to Be Nation, Scott Criscola and Justin Rosero. This is the Place to Be podcast.
Very nice, Mr. Criscola.
Oh, I'm sorry, Dennis.
I think they might hit a shock wall.
Actually, it's being John Akiyama is a better version of it.
What do you think, Woodley? You can finally tell Grant Owens you found new music.
I'll tell you what, I am impressed. Mm-hmm.
Sharon Lawson Bram, skid of a rinky dinky dink.
Yeah.
Skid of a rinky do.
Hey, Nate, man, this is pretty much a highlight of my life right now. I had no idea you were going to be here. I wanted to drive that freaking ho train of my whole youth. You're the man.
And I thought he meant Nate Milton, the Godfather from Kings of Sport. Do you really think that's the Godfather?
Yeah, I did.
All you have to do is break out that fuck money.
I ate the pot. Like a mouthy scraggly Canadian.
That's a bit much. You who murdered the dog with the sword, and I'm being a little too much.
Yeah, I like Big Dick myself. I'm just curious. 5 years! 5 years! We've been doing podcasts. And we have this. This is trash.
To do worse than Josh Richard.
That'll walk right out on me. And if the sun comes up tomorrow.
Place to Be Nation, welcome back to the great episode of the one and only Place to Be podcast. I am your co-host, Justin Zero, coming to you live here on this Tuesday evening, mixing things up just a little bit here on the mothership. And of course, joining me as always is my PIC, Mr. Scott Criscola. Scott, how are you?
Good evening, JR. Good evening, Place to Be Nation. Welcome to episode 452 of the Gold Standard. Yeah, we're switching things up a little bit. Tuesday evening here. Same thing here in Studio B. We, instead of having Raw on mute, we have SmackDown Live on mute, but roughly the same. JR, always good to talk to you, sir. How are you? How's things going?
Yeah, doing okay. I'm ready for the rain to be done. Yes.
Yeah, every time I want to wash my car, nature does it for me. And then when I'm like, oh, well, the rain just made it dirty, and then I'm going to wash it, and then, of course, the rain comes back.
Yeah.
I hope it does not rain next Wednesday.
Right now, the forecast looks good.
All right, good. Supposed to be a good week next week because, of course, next Monday is our Sword and Shield Golf Classic, and right mm-hmm. now it's supposed to be 86 and sunny, so that's good. Fingers crossed on that. So
poor Mento, you better get him a big thing of Arnold Palmer's. And
oh yeah, we got to get a golf cart. A big hat, unlike him, I have hair, so got if he doesn't have a hat, yes, I don't know what's going to happen to that scalp.
Just give him those big bucket hats.
Be like Buckethead and Guns N' Roses. Anyway, JR, it's good to be back, my friend. Mm-hmm. And tonight, episode 452, we leave our Tri-City situation of WrestleMania 2. A good show there. Mm-hmm. I want to thank Mr. D'Amato. He was an exceptional guest that night. Had a good show. But JR, tonight we're back in our old office. We're back in the offices here on 33rd Street, 33rd Avenue, otherwise known as Madison Square Garden, which means, JR, guess who's back in the house?
Yes,
the third member of the Goldust Trio has returned.
He has, and he's freshly married. We got the ring on his finger, and that is Mr. Kelly Nelson. Kelly, how are you?
Doing great. Yeah, it was a match made in heaven.
Not saying miserable yet, or is it okay?
There was no surprise appearance by Undertaker and Jake Roberts at the reception. So
let's also hope that this wedding, the marriage, lasts longer than Butcher Vachon's does as well. Yes. So.
Well, did you have any midgets getting tripped at your wedding?
No, I don't think so. No, it was pretty tame. Except I was way out of it by the end, but that was to be expected.
Albano was out of it at the ceremony, so
you're good company. So, well, congratulations to you, sir. But we missed you.
Yes.
We dealt with the rhino in the China shop, and Pete was in here filling in that week. Yeah, he was great as always. But it's always good to have you back. I feel like we're complete when you're here. So,
yes.
And
of course, you being here, Kel, means that we are back in the house. So let's dive right in. Our date is April 22nd, 1986. So about 2 weeks after WrestleMania 2, live from, of course, the home office, Madison Square Garden in New York City. Pretty good crowd this evening, close to a sellout. Your announcer, strange combo tonight. Of course, Gorilla Monsoon, our play-by-play guy. No Jesse tonight.
Nope.
Lord Alfred Hayes returns, but a third member, JR. I don't know if in our Jarvis report we have a bio on him, but I guess we'll mention him in a moment. But before we go any further, I don't say the B team, I always say this, but the, I guess, A2 team was not far away tonight. The other half of the roster was in Rochester tonight at the War Memorial. Here is your card. Bret Hart defeated SD Jones. Dan Spivey over Moondog Spot. Jim Brunzel beat Hercules. Jim Neidhart over B. Brian Blair. George Steele, so thank God we don't get him tonight, defeated Adrian Adonis, which is a crime. The main event does not have a result, but it was Junkyard Dog, Ricky Steamboat, and the Haiti Kid against Dory Funk Jr., somebody that was subbing in for Terry Funk. We won't say who that is because I'm sure we'll see him somewhere down the line, apparently another family member, and Jimmy Hart. So there was your card in Rochester on this night, so only a couple hours north. JR, the Jarvis Report, does he include, does the report include this third play-by, or this third commentator, or should I just mention him?
Well, you can mention him. We can talk about him. First, let's talk about our, well, let's talk about our champions first, so we don't,
don't
get bitched at. Hulk Hogan is our WWF champion, 820 days into his reign. Randy Savage, Intercontinental Champion, 73 days. British Bulldogs is 15 days, of course, into their reign after WrestleMania 2. And the Fabulous Moolah, Buck 48 as women's champion, and there you go. I can check the good notes box, so we're good there. Yeah, Ernie Ladd, Scott, is our third man in the booth, our color commentator. And, you know, we'll talk about it as we move along, but I thought he was a nice little addition. I enjoyed him, and we actually heard him at WrestleMania 2 as well, if you remember. He was announcing the Battle Royal between the NFL and WWF stars. He was the third man in that booth there. Of course, drafted in the NFL, played for the Bears, the Chargers as well. He was in Grambling State University star, and he transitioned to pro wrestling, and was a pretty big deal. He was a, you know, well-regarded heel, right? He was a big-time heel and does some commentary here. And I think he does some other stuff, too, with WWF when it comes to commentary. I don't think it's just this. But he's around until through 86. Kelly, anything you want to add about Ladd's career or, you know, either this run or his wrestling?
I mean, yeah, he was a big star in the AFL in the 60s. He played, I think, mostly for the Kansas City Chiefs. And I think he was part of like the all AFL team for the 60s, if I'm not mistaken. Mm-hmm. And then, yeah, he was big. Like he was doing both. He was doing football and wrestling at the same time in the 60s, first as a babyface, and then he turned heel. Actually, the first time he went to New York in 1968 and had a run with Bruno. That was his first heel run. And from there, he like in the 70s, he was one of the top heels in wrestling. You saw him on the cover of magazines all the time with a crown on, you know, very hated. He has some good stuff in the mid-70s in the WWF that's out there. Some good promos, great promos, interactions with Vince Jr. And, yeah, at this point he was – yeah, they tried him as a color commentator. He was – he does the big event later in the year. I know that.
Yes.
I think. Yeah. Mm-hmm.
I think he did some TV too, didn't he? Wasn't he on there?
Yeah, maybe. He was kind of random. There was a lot of experimentation,
right,
in 1986 with the commentators, and he was part of it. But yeah, I don't think he lasted past the end of the year.
Right. No, he is gone by the end of '86. He would also own his own barbecue restaurant in New Orleans that was destroyed in Hurricane Katrina. So he had that until that point, and then. He did pass away. He was diagnosed with colon cancer in 2004, and his doctor said he had only 3 to 6 months, and he lived another 3 years, passed away in 2007. So, yeah, Big Cat, legendary figure, of course, Hall of Famer. And it was cool. I thought he added a lot here. I really enjoyed him on this night.
I actually just, until you just said that, JR, I actually had forgotten that he had passed away. I'm kind of sad now, because I thought he was tremendous tonight, because I'll tell you something, and I'm going to document this as we move on tonight. I thought he needed to be good, because I'll be honest with you, Gorilla and Alfred were not in their game tonight, in my opinion, and I'll delve deeper into it as we move along. Kel, what was the general opinion on the Titans ensemble of Ernie Ladd Was Parv a fan? Seemed like he was, right?
Oh, yeah. We all loved him. I mean, we didn't see a lot of him just in, like, the Backlund era. He came in for, like, a real brief cup of coffee in 1980.
Mm-hmm.
The one episode of Titans I remember the most with Ladd was Johnny, Pete, and myself. We did a Black History Month when they had that playlist up or collection up on the network.
Oh, right. Right.
Yeah, and that, and Ladd was heavily featured on that. So that episode, I believe, was number 43 of Titans, where we talk a lot about Ernie Ladd. And that promo I talked about with Vince Jr., it's a really great one where he calls Bobo Brazil and Uncle Tom.
That's funny. Well, if you want to check out some good Ernie Ladd, both heel and babyface, go on the network and watch some of those 1982 Mid-Souths. Yeah. He is tremendous on those. He was managing the Samoans, and then they got swiped from under him by Skandor Akbar, another one of my favorite managers of all time. And then he came back. It was awesome. And of course, what compliments Ernie Ladd for me tonight is the unbelievable shade of red his hair is. It was very impressive. I don't know if that was a dye job or what that was, but it was very impressive color of on his fro on this evening at the Garden. It was very nice. So we are in the house, and JR, dive in. Match number one.
Sure. Just before that, we have two things that have happened since WrestleMania 2 here. Just real brief. On the April 12th episode of Championship Wrestling, Roddy Piper had the week off, and Jimmy Hart filled in on the pit. And this week, the guest was Jake Roberts. We learned for the first time the name of the snake that he carries to the ring, and that is Damien.
Yes.
So it was revealed. The next week, Piper returned with Cowboy Bob. King Kong Bundy and John Studd came out and issued a challenge to Andre the Giant and a partner of his choice for a big tag team match on national television. So that's it.
I watched both of those episodes. It was very funny. The Jimmy Hart, the one with Jimmy Hart in for Piper was great because it was like Jimmy Hart was Piper and Haas Funk was the Orton role. Like he was standing behind Jimmy Hart in the Orton role when Jake was out. It was actually really fun. It was a fun episode. Hmm. And then the following one you were talking about, it was great because Studd and Bundy come out and they're talking about how they're going to slam Andre and Piper kept making Orton be like the guinea pig for them as they're trying to practice slamming. It was very good. Good 2 weeks of championship wrestling episodes leading up to this. It was very good. But it was weird seeing somebody else. Like, I didn't remember that Jimmy Hart was actually pinch hitting for Piper in a pit. I never knew that before until I watched. I don't remember that until I watched that episode. It was very, very cool, actually. And Haas was the Orton role. And he had a hat on. He had his cowboy hat on. So it was pretty cool. It was very impressive. Yeah. Obviously those shows, the one the week after didn't allude to WrestleMania too much. The one after that, the 19th, as you said, JR, they actually re-aired pretty much the entire Bulldogs Dream Team match.
Oh, wow.
On that episode of Championship Wrestling. They almost gave you the full match. So it's pretty good that following week, the 19th, the one that precedes this show. So, all right. As mentioned, let's dive into our opener. Two of our favorite MSG stalwarts, JR.
Our favorite opening acts here is Rene Goulet, the Michael Jackson of the World Wrestling Federation, taking on Lanny Poffo. Interesting here, but I thought on paper this could be pretty decent. We'll see. Poffo dishes out his frisbees and delivers his poem about Rene. Goulet takes his time disrobing and puts on his glove. His gorilla says he's abandoned the Scorpio Claw, hasn't won a match in several months. 7 months, I think he even says. Alfred says, though, he thought he used it recently with some success, so they argue over that. Al and Gorilla then talk about Goulet dropping weight but maintaining his strength still, which is unique, and I think they've had the same exact conversation about the claw and his weight like 5 times already. Ladd talks about his experience with weight while he was double-dipping in wrestling and football. We get a couple of lockups and trading of holds to open things up, each time ending with a reset. Alfred says Poffo has greatly progressed as Lanny works the arm, controlling Goulet. Goulet reverses the hold, and now he works the arm, grabbing a near fall before releasing and begging off. Things reset again with more trading and control as Goulet works as in his usual comedy spots. Poffo heats up and slings Goulet into the corner and then crotches him on the top rope before slugging him off the top and eventually down to the floor. Ladd talks about the weight loss helps Goulet's mindset, as Gorilla and Al put over Lanny for keeping his cool and staying focused. Goulet regains control and stomps twice on Lanny's stomach before punching away, clotheslining Poffo down and grabbing that Scorpio Claw so he hasn't abandoned it completely. Ladd rambles on about the clothesline being banned in football for some reason as Lanny tries to fight out of the claw, which he breaks by powering to his feet. Poffo shoots Goulet to the corner but comes up empty on a charge, leading to another Scorpio.
Lanny breaks free again, but misses a dropkick, leading to a Goulet near fall. Goulet hooks the claw for a third time, but it fails again as Poffo fights free and comes out firing, aggressively working Rene over with right hands. Poffo slams Goulet, but misses the second rope backflip. Goulet then covers, but Poffo survives. Goulet heads up top. Poffo meets him and slams into the mat and then hits a somersault splash for the win. And this was decent. Had some good stuff, and it was slowed down by the claws, as always. Like, Goulet, these matches would be, on average, a half star better if he just didn't work that fucking claw three times a match. Because by the third time, you're just done. You're so done with it. Goulet got all his comedy in early. And in the end, I thought was the best part of the match when he missed that backflip dive tease into the finish. But again, the claw just grinds these matches down when he's out there. I went one star for this one because I like the finish and I like some of the comedy to open up was pretty good. Scott.
Interesting match here. By the way, we're talking about nicknames. You said that Rene Goulet is the Michael Jackson. Well, what does Gorilla constantly call Lanny now?
The Poet Laureate. The
Poet Laureate. Yes. So everybody's got a friggin' nickname now. I think I gave this a star as well. I just lost my page, but it's funny because Rene Goulet is a pretty solid worker, and it's funny that they constantly comment about how he hasn't won a match in months with the claw, and then, you know, Alfred, who just kind of pulls shit out of his butt, is talking about, I thought I saw him win a match a while back with it and all this kind of stuff. And I think they almost got too specific about the claw, and kind of, I wonder if they're trying to like enhance the move itself for him to use it. I don't know. It was very strange, but the match itself was fine. Rene needs a haircut, though. My God, that ridiculous coif is getting out of control. It's going crazy. He's got none of that. He looks like Gallagher, blonde Gallagher, or you know, Waylon Mercy or something. Anyway, he's totally out of control. He needs a haircut. I can't say the match was stiffer, though. I'm curious your thoughts too, Kel. That like Lanny. Like we said, when we talked about his career in Memphis, he was a heel, so he did work a little dirtier and a little, you know, stiffer than he would when he first arrived in the WWF because as a babyface. But I've noticed his last few matches doing a lot of more right hand, stiffer uppercuts, hitting stuff crisper, and I like that in him. And I think it actually enhances the match a little bit. I agree with you, JR, that Renee's got a get back to just doing a good match and being formulaic and making a match look good instead of trying to circumvent around to the claw, which seems to happen every match and bog the match down. Again, I gave it a star as well. I wanted to give it more because your runtime, a lot of long matches on this show, your runtime 13:16. So they got a pretty decent amount of time for the opener. But I gave it a star. I was expecting more, actually, and I didn't get it. And again, I agree with JR. I think it's because trying to like work the claw in totally throws off the rest of the match. But I did like Lanny's, actually working stiffer, even as a babyface. So I gave it a star. What'd you think, Kel?
Yeah, I thought this was a good opener. I think I've seen it three times now, which is maybe more times than anyone in history. But Poffo, yeah, he's pretty good at this time, actually. But Fink is not too impressed, as when he introduces him, he says something like, Poffo has a poem, as usual. Like he was like just tired of the poem gimmick already or something.
I'm burying it.
Yeah. This was a rematch of a curtain jerker from a couple months back, remember, in February. And I thought this was a much better match between the two. There was nice mat work to start between them. The crowd was actually into it right away, which is unusual for an MSG opener. There was no boring chants that I heard, so that's a big plus. Goulet was doing all right with the stooging and bumping. And, Ernie Ladd as a commentator. Someone, you know, at times I thought felt kind of out of place or didn't, you know, mesh with his great promo skills. He definitely loves the football analogies.
Oh, yeah. He goes like in and out of being good. Like he'll have this really salient point that adds a lot. And then 2 minutes later, he's just rambling on about nothing. So, I mean, it's like, it almost doesn't even seem like it's the same guy half the time because he's poignant 1 minute and then lost the next.
that's what I was going to say. A lot of rambling, and especially later on. I thought, you know, it was a good finish with the cannonball from Poffo, and yeah. I gave it 1.5 stars.
And that's what you get. Actually, so the one back in February, you gave 1 star. I gave 1.5, and Scott, you gave 2 stars to that one. So.
Oh wow! So you guys like that one better? Interesting.
Slightly. Yes.
Yeah, and one last comment. This would actually be Rene Goulet's last MSG match.
What? So, that's it? We're done?
Yeah, yeah. I think we're done because he's not going to be on Saturday Night's Main Event. He's not going to be on any big shows.
Definitely.
So, this is it. Goodbye for the number one Frenchman.
Wow, kind of sad. I've gotten used to him. I would have maybe given us a higher grade. I would have appreciated it more while he was here if I knew this was it. So he transitions pretty soon then into being an agent, right? Or does he wrestle a little bit more still before transitioning? Because, I mean, he's with the company for a long time.
Yeah, he worked probably a few more months maybe and just didn't get on an MSG show. But I knew it was coming close to the end because I know by the time I got into wrestling later in 86, he was completely, he wasn't in the ring anymore.
Actually, he's wrestling right through the end of the year, it looks like, according to Graham. Yeah, in December he's got like a bunch of matches. I mean, it's a little sporadic, but no, it's pretty regular. He's got 98 matches total in 86, so. Yeah, he's pretty active, so let's see 87. Goulet, 2 matches into early 87. So it looks like, oh, actually, he has 1 in January, and then he's on that East Rutherford show in November. Is that the one that was, like, meant to be the Battle Royal? Yeah, it's the Battle Royal. Luthez wins the Battle Royal. That's the one that pissed off Savage. He wanted his dad to be in the Battle Royal or whatever, and Vince.
That was, like, a Legends reunion Battle Royal.
Right.
Maybe I did see Goulet on some of the early shows that I watched, but... Yeah, I was pretty sure he was done.
Yeah, I was going to say, so he's pretty much all through 86, yeah.
Yeah.
Scott kind of touched on it. Poffo's aggressive offense, I like when he breaks that out. And, like, I like how they call it out, how he can get pissed off enough and just go into this, like, super, like, the scratching and clawing and punching. And, like, I like when he breaks it out when he gets pissed. And it seems like his trigger is getting shorter and shorter in these matches. Like, he goes to the brawling quicker, which is kind of neat. Like, he gets right down to business a lot faster instead of fucking around.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, no, it's good to see these longer Lanny Poffo matches because, you know, I'm mostly familiar with him just from the Saturday morning TV quickies. And he's got, a pretty decent rep as being a pretty good hand at this time. So I'm definitely interested going forward seeing what he can produce.
Agreed. All right, so why don't we move on to our next match? We continue on here, and that is Nikolai Volkoff battling Tony Garea. Been a while since we've seen Big Tony here in MSG, and longer while since Nikolai's been in a match like this on an MSG card. I feel like he's either been part of the Foreign Legion or he's, been in big tag title matches. Like, we haven't really seen him in the bottom end of a card against a guy like Garea, maybe at all, since we started this. Nikolai gets his whole anthem in. Garea gets a warm hand from the crowd. And we've seen Garea like twice, I think. We saw the Bundy match and then maybe one other time. So it's been sporadic for him as well here in these shows. Garea says that outside of Ted Arcidi, Nikolai is one of the strongest men in the world. Nikolai comes right at Garea off the bell, working with clubbing blows and knees. And Garea dodges a charge and hammers away before catching Nikolai with a knee lift into a small package for two. Garea works a side headlock as Blassie looks on with concern. Nikolai clubs his way back to control, but Garea blocks a kick and drops the Russian with an atomic drop for two. Nikolai goes to the eyes and chokes away, but misses a dive off the middle rope. Garea threatens a low blow and delivers it before working over the knee. Nikolai turns the tide again, getting an assist from Blassie, who jabs Tony with his cane. Garea comes back with a stiff right hand, and we get some sloppy miscommunication. Garea drops Nikolai with a back elbow, then follows that with a knee drop for two. Garea gets a near fall on a sunset flip and a backslide, but comes up empty on a charge in the corner, crotching himself on the buckle. Nikolai pounces and drops Garea with a backbreaker for the win. This had some energy and a decent flow, filled with awkward spots, so sloppiness from both men. There was enough here not to make it a dud, I thought, but just barely. And Nikolai rolls on looking for something, anything of substance. So I went 0.5 star here because I thought they had at least a little bit of energy to it. But again, you know, a lot of awkwardness and sloppiness as usual for Nikolai and Garea both. Where did you have this one at, Kelly?
Same rating, 0.5 star. Very sloppy. Garea just seems so outdated by this time. I mean, you know, we know his career stretched back into the early 70s, and he was in New York forever. But just watching this, and it's funny because Nikolai is not exactly super young himself. And I had to check the ages of these guys at the time. And Gurria was only 39.
Jeez.
And I'm 39. So I feel...
He looks like he's 50.
I don't know
50.
How I feel. Yeah, exactly. And Nikolai was actually a year young. No. Yeah, he was a year younger. Nikolai was only 38.
Wow.
At this time. I know. I thought for sure both were in their 40s.
Wow.
Right. I know. But yeah, this is like a total 70s matchup. Two guys from the 70s, especially Gurria. He's moving in slow motion through a lot of this match. And I love Tony, you know, I mean, with that hair, how can you not love the guy?
Are you going to vote for him in your top 100 for greatest WWE wrestler ever?
If he makes it, it would be in the 90 to 100 range.
He should be in the 290 to 300 range, probably.
Well, I mean, yeah, I mean, he had five tag team championship runs. Yeah. One with Haystacks Calhoun, too.
Yeah, me and Scott could have had a tag title run in 1977.
Yeah.
Although, yeah. Only he was looking for young boys, like on TNT. So I got some young boys I'm looking at. Of course you are.
Yeah, no, I mean, it's crazy. I mean, we talk about Goulet, this being his last show. I mean, I don't think Tony's got too many left in the tank at this point. So, yeah, no, this just was not a very good match at all.
Yeah, I mean, I don't know what they're going to try to accomplish at this point with Nikolai and Sheik as solo stars. They might as well just keep them tag team. Seems kind of a waste to even bother making them a tag team. And, I mean, maybe Tony Gurria, well, it doesn't say it on Graham's site. Tony Gurria wasn't subbing for anybody, so the fact that they had him show up and wrestle anyway speaks volumes, I suppose, about whoever's right. Not on the roster or whatever. But, yeah, I mean, this match isn't much. It's your official time, 6:54, and it was kind of a meandering mess. I don't know what the future holds for Nikolai at this point. As we'll see throughout 86 into early 87, they are going to boost the tag team division, and these guys will probably kind of be left behind, which is unfortunate, but the match wasn't much. So I also gave it a half star. Again, they tried hard, so I agree with you. It's like what you said, JR. It's kind of hard to really – dud this. We'll have our share of duds later, but they did try to work hard here. But Nikolai is just, I'm not quite sure what they're going to do with him yet. And Tony Gurria probably should just buy his suit with his WWF logo on the blazer and just get ready for the second chapter, for the next chapter of your life.
I'd rather have Goulet stick around than him. I enjoy Goulet a little bit more at this point.
I enjoy Goulet too, once he can trim that coiffed hair he's got. But, although Tony Gurria was looking, we should probably have the best hair award coming up soon because everybody had some fine do's on this night. I'll tell you, Renee was out of control and Gurria's was like, you know, perfectly blow dried. So, so all right. Speaking of great jobbers, one of my favorites coming up next year in our next match here
is that Paul Christie who's battling King Tonga. Let's talk about Paul Christie, real name Paul Christerson, near the end of his career. He was born.
That sounds even faker than Christie. Christerson?
Yes, Christerson.
Even that sounds more fake than Christie does.
You think so?
Yeah.
I guess we could debate that. Born in March of 1939. Began his wrestling career shortly after high school. Christie started working for the American Health Studio chain. His manager, Jack Thornton, was a wrestler in the area and thought Christie had a good look. Asked him to give it a shot. Christie agreed to one match, which he won, had the right look, and billed to be a wrestler. After the match, he was hooked. Christie moved to Chicago and began working for Fred Kohler. 1960, the fans voted him Rookie of the Year. Later moved on to Texas, where he worked with Dory Funk Sr., moving on to work to Arizona and then Alabama, and later on moved back to Chicago to work in the WWA, met Bunny Burmester during this time, and convinced Dick the Bruiser to let her be his manager. The two were a couple outside the ring, and during the early 80s, the duo was known as wrestling's Bonnie and Clyde, spending most of their time in Angelo Poffo's ICW. During his time there, Christie defeated Randy Savage for the ICW heavyweight title and would join the WWF as a jobber from there. Kelly, anything else you have on Paul Christie?
No, I wish I did. I outside of this match, I mean, I yeah, I've probably seen others, but no, I don't. I mean, and speaking of outdated looks, his hair is straight from the 1950s, at least at the beginning.
So we're 3 for 3 on great hair tonight, right?
Yeah, this is it's like a Hall of Fame of hair tonight.
I didn't realize the legendary background this guy had when he comes in here. So,
wow, I didn't realize he beat Savage for a title. That's kind of kind of out of nowhere.
Impressive, yeah.
All right, King Tonga back at it, looking to improve his way up the ladder after that tough loss to Morocco last time we were here. They give him some fodder to help him get reestablished, and Gorilla and Alfred put over Christie's experience, and Ernie says he has a real mean streak. And I thought he looked like a villain in a soap opera when I saw him out there, so I guess that speaks to the hair. We get some locking up and clean breaks to open things up as Gorilla wonders how Tonga got so big when he's just eating only coconuts and bananas. They trade work on the arm until Tonga grabs control and breaks down Christie. Al reminds us of Tonga's big suction cup feet, as always. Gorilla and Ernie have a debate, talking about how they could never wrestle barefoot. Christie punches his way into control, but Tonga battles right back with some thrusts and kicks and works over Christie as Ernie says he's making a mistake, trying to go toe-to-toe instead of using his speed. Christie forces Tonga to the mat, chokes away, and buries some knees. Tonga battles back again with thrusts and kicks and slams Christie, and then does a little dance before dropping some big fists. And Tonga heads up top and drops a big falling headbutt on Christie for the win. Nothing match here, mainly because Christie had nothing. He had nothing left in the tank. I don't know how good he ever was, but zero believable offense in this match. I thought Tonga looked good, though. He's improving. He just needs something more to work with and get him going. I gave this one a dud. They didn't really have much going on, Scott.
Yeah, I think my main concern here was the match seemed very clumsy. I felt like Paul Christie really didn't know what to do with Tonga. Like, the headlocks looked awkward, and I feel like he didn't really know what to do with the guy. Like, if there was any kind of believable offense, what to do with King Tonga. And that's what I think was the problem. Your official rump match time is 5:57, perfect length, maybe 4 minutes too long. But it just seemed like Paul Christie didn't know what to do, like how to get around this large guy's offense and Tonga, pretty big dude, relatively speaking. And I felt like Christie just didn't know what to do with him. Like, the headlocks looked awkward. You know, he does that same little kind of, the way he walks with his pumping his arms out with that, finely Jimmy Dean hair. And I don't know. Something just didn't hit. I don't know, maybe he should have come in with like a greaser gimmick. I don't know, but wouldn't that have been great? He put like a cigarette in his ear.
Cigarettes rolled up in his sleeve.
Exactly. A pack of Marlboro rolled up in his white t-shirt.
Yeah.
And, but I mean, he didn't know what to do with him. Like, he just seemed very clumsy. What'd you think, Cal? I felt like I also gave it a dud. It just wasn't good. But I felt like he didn't know. There were times where he didn't know what to do with King Tonga to at least get some heel offense in. He just seemed lost in there.
Yeah, no, he didn't look good. I gave it a dud, too. I mean, he was born during the Great Depression, so by this point, he was getting pretty close to 50. yeah, I don't know. I mean, probably limited experience in the territory, maybe just, I don't know. Anyway, this is the type of match, and we're familiar now with how it goes at MSG, where you get the names come up on the screen before the match begins. This is the one where you like sigh when you see the names coming up because you have to sit through this match. And it's weird because I love Tonga. I love Haku, but I've seen 3 matches of his now at MSG and I've given them all duds.
Were you not here for the Morocco one? Is that the one you missed?
That's the one I missed. So that wouldn't have been a dud, but he was against Les Thornton, I believe. Ron Shaw and now Paul Christie. So not exactly a murderer's row of workers there. But yeah, in the boring chance, I think this is the first time they appear tonight. There was no heat. And yeah, this match was boring. Like the chants were totally justified for this one. It was totally boring. I didn't like it at all.
No, not good. Yeah, Tonga's guy. I mean, it'll be interesting when he puts it together. We'll see.
I know
it's coming, right? So it's it'll be interesting when it happens because I thought he was figuring it out. I think this one, like those earlier matches, I thought were on him. This one I felt was fully on Christie. I don't think he had a shot in this one to do anything positive.
I agree
with Christie. Like him and Morocco is pretty good. So I feel like I'm going to chalk this one up to Christie versus him. So maybe he's still on that upward trajectory, but we'll see. Guys who are not on upward trajectory, talk about next, and that is the legendary bane of our existence, Superfly Siviafi taking on Iron Mike Sharp. Disaster is written all over it. And I actually had to – I don't know how it even came up the other night at Extreme Rules when we had a little gathering here. And I think I was talking about it with D'Amato and Souza or something. And Roger was like, oh, who's Siviafi? And I ended up sitting here for 5 minutes explaining who the fuck Siviafi was. And I'm like, you're never going to watch a match. I'm like, I don't know why I'm wasting my time explaining who he is to you. But here we are. Afi comes in with a traditional garb, but much more subdued again. Al says Sharp is one of his favorite wrestlers and wonders how he can keep up with Afi, though. Sharp begs off and stalls to start, and we get really awkward crisscross that ends with a sharp hammerlock. Afi works out, gets two on a roll-up with a referee fucked up and seemed to count three. I swear Afi's so bad he just infects everyone in the match. Like, the referee's always fucking lost in his match. It's like, it's just bad across the board. Afi dropkicks Sharp and then punches him to the floor as Aldous cannot stop giggling about everything Sharp does. I mean, he is like in love with Iron Mike Sharp. He's just laughing nonstop at everything. Sharp returns, but after more nonsense, Afi knocks him back outside over the barricade with a dropkick. Sharp comes back in and grabs hold of the arm, but Afi works free and lands a dropkick and whiffs on a second one. Sharp goes to work on the back and slugs and clubs away. Al says Afi is usually oily, smooth, and efficient, but Sharp has knocked him off course. Afi gets a crossbody for two, but Sharp remains in control, locking in a bear hug. Afi clobbers Sharp's ears to break the hold and runs him to the top buckle and fires up. Sharp comes back with some offense, and Afi battles right back again and lands a crappy-looking clothesline and comes up empty on an elbow drop. Afi recovers and whips Sharp into the corner and then hits a one-legged dropkick. However, Sharp dodges a headbutt off the middle rope. Sharp takes Afi over with a near fall and then lays into Afi with a heavy chop, and they trade some offense. Afi gets a near fall, and after a headbutt to the midsection, Afi slams Sharp and gets a reverse splash off the middle rope for two. Al calls Sharp incredible as he hangs in there and rocks Afi with a running knee to the head. Sharp drops Afi to the, but he hangs him on the top rope and then gets Sharp and then pulls Sharp to the floor with his feet. Sharp hammers Afi on the floor, but they get tangled up and fight for a while as the referee just stands there. Afi skins the cat back in and nearly botches it, not having enough gas to do it cleanly as usual. Sharp gets kicked back to the outside and Afi wins by countout as Gorilla and Al just rip the ref for mangling the whole count. Sharp attacks Afi after the bell. Afi comes back and sends him running with a really awkward finish, I thought, to the blah match. Sharp is his usual self. He got his usual match. He keeps coming back every time you think he's cooked, and he does a stalling to start and keeps going to the floor. Afi keeps botching and butchering everything because he's fucking gassed and uncoordinated. I thought Sharp looked fine. Afi just sucks, and the crowd booed when he won. Even worse. Usual slop. I gave it a slight bump for Sharp, and I enjoyed Alfred here just giggling uncontrollably over him. So I went half a star. Just the entertainment of Alfred and Sharp, and I mean, Afi's just he's just an energy suck at this point. He's just awful, and he's sucking wind as well, and he's sucking the wind out of the arena when he wrestles. What did you think of this disaster, Kelly?
This is another sigh match when you see the names come up. Even though I've kind of come around on Sharp lately, and I thought, you know, this could be okay maybe, but no, I was totally wrong. Afi's just horrible. Can't even execute a leapfrog. Like, every time he tries that, he fucks it up. You know, Sharp bumped his ass off to make the slug look good. Mm-hmm. But to no avail. Siviafi is like a bad Halloween costume of Jimmy Snuka. Right? It's like you love Jimmy Snuka, you know, and you want to be him for Halloween, and then this is what they have to offer. Is something that doesn't even look like Jimmy Snuka.
Awful. I mean, it is. Just, he is just awful. Everything he does is fucking awful. Just botches, clumsy.
Yeah, so many botches.
Gassed out of his. Just completely gassed. Every like 3 minutes in, got no energy, no wind. I mean, he can't even skin the cat. He like almost collapses when he's trying to do it. Just awful. I mean, he's got nothing. He's got nothing in the tank. Nothing at all.
He's got nothing. No, it is one of the greatest train wrecks in WWF history. It's totally not talked about because, you know, no one cares about Siviafi, and he goes away, you know, not too long after this. But really, if you watch it from the beginning with the horrible attempt to, like, you know, fool the fans into thinking that Superfly Snuka was back. And then from there with the Shaft music, like, what a start. And then just every match after has been horrible, and it's just such a nightmare. It's so bad. Dud for me on this. I gave it a half star at first, but then I gave it like a moment or two to think about it. I was like, fuck it, no, it's got to be a dud. I'm not giving anything with Assy any kind of star rating.
Al, what did you think? Did you enjoy Alfred?
I guess. I mean, I was just too, like, the Offie being so horrible just overpowered everything for me.
God, he loved the Sharp, man. He loved him. Everything he did, he was giggling like a schoolgirl out of control. It was great. What do you think, Scott?
I think that's a perfect explanation, Kel, that CV Offie went to, like, Amazing or Target and tried to find, like, you know, oh, these look like Snuka tights. And I mean, he didn't even know, like, when he gets in the ring and dances, he doesn't even do that well. You know, like, it's everything about it's just bad. But I almost think that, like, I didn't know what to think here in the sense that, by the way, your runtime, you ready for this? You ready how long you had to sit through this mess? 13:51. Probably felt like 43:51, but I gave it a half star because I will never give a dud to Iron Mike Sharp. I wasn't sure where they were going. Did they still believe in him, or were they giving up on him? Because I felt mixed signals in this match. Because on the one hand, he still comes in, he's got the grass freaking skirt, and he's still dancing in the ring, and you know he's still got some big moves, and he wins the match. But they kind of make fun of him, and you know, Alfred, of course, and his overt love for Canada's greatest athlete. And then he doesn't even win the match clean. He wins by count out. I mean, if you're not going to beat Iron Mike Sharp clean.
I thought it was going to go to a double count out. I was like, my God, like he was really bad. It looked like they were going to protect Sharp and have him go to a double count out. And then he beats, I mean, they basically did. I mean, he barely beats the count in.
They really did.
Yeah.
So that made me think, result alone, that they were just, they're done with this moron. He's just not good. He's clumsy. Probably looks like he overcycled on some roids because he doesn't even look like Snuka jacked. I mean, he looks like he can't do, like you said, he can't jump high enough for leapfrogs. I mean, he's a mess. He's an absolute mess. And you will slowly see him probably not even showing up. I mean, we'll see some MSG matches, but
I mean, he's around for another year, Plo. I mean, they don't give up right away. he's around for a while. I don't know. I don't know how much he's on MSG, but he's around. Yeah, he's not going.
No, he's definitely around. It's just a question of whether he actually really starts jobbing out big time and starts, you know, putting over everybody and anybody. But yeah, I give Iron Mike Sharp a half star. I'll say it that way. But Gorilla and Alfred are just a mess tonight. Like I feel like they're off the track and. And I love Ernie Ladd's analysis using boxing and using other sports, and he sounds intelligent. Whereas times Gorilla and Alfred are kind of using the same wrestling tropes that you would use in, you know, typical mid 80s play by play, and sometimes it just sounds so played out. And I feel like they were very lazy tonight, and Ernie Ladd kind of saved the show from announce wise being a complete mess. CD Offie cannot be saved, even by Ernie Ladd. So I give this a half star for Iron Mike Sharp because he does put his character over. He works his butt off, and he does everything that needs to be done on his end of the match. It's a question of whether whoever he's with is going to hold their end, and CD Offie just can't hold anything to anybody anymore. He's an absolute mess, and this was an experiment that failed of epic proportions. And he wins by count out. I mean, if you can't pin, I mean, really, if you don't get a pinfall win over over Iron Mike Sharp, are you even worth it?
Yeah, I mean, we're seeing the Sharp decline. It started with when they stripped the music, and then they stripped his, you know, dance routine and the flames and everything else, and now it's down to barely beating Mike Sharp. I mean, he's going to be the flip side of this very soon, where he's the guy
putting
everyone else over. It's almost there.
Yeah.
He's about to crater. All right, we go backstage. Gorilla Monsoon is with the Dream Team and Johnny V. He asks why V put them in singles action, and Johnny says he wants to show what they possess, that they're still champs through and through, and they'll prove it tonight. Gorilla says WrestleMania was a nightmare, but Hammer says the real nightmare starts tonight for the Bulldogs, and Beefcake says he's gonna pick Dynamite over his head and slam him. So High aspirations of the Beefer here tonight, as he is slated to take on Dynamite Kid. That is next. Continuing our big tag title feud with a singles war, the Dream Team looking to stay relevant and get their gold back. Good heat on Beefcake and a big pop for Dynamite. Al still wonders why V took these matches as we get underway with some feeling out. Dynamite plants Beefer with a hard shoulder block, and then a second one sends Brutus outside to regroup. Brutus slowly makes his way back inside, and we get a lockup. Beefcake takes control of the arm, but Dynamite wriggles free, and then he hooks the arm or works it over. Ernie talks about the dangers of the ring and how you could chip a bone in your elbow and not even know it until after the match. Dynamite cranks a side headlock, but Beefer breaks it up with a hard backdrop. Beefcake follows with a falling headbutt to the abdomen and gets to work, including a really nice vertical suplex for two. Johnny V, I wanted to mention, is rocking a skin-tight Ranger shirt. Interesting choice tonight. Dynamite gets a flash near fall and a roll-up, but Beefcake maintains control and stomps away. Dynamite comes back with a series of headbutts and a crisp snap suplex and then drops a headbutt. Dynamite goes for a leaping headbutt, but Brutus drops down and Kid flies to the floor. Brutus dips into his tights and cracks Dynamite with an object as he climbs into the ring. Beefcake tries to suplex Dynamite in, but Dynamite floats over and rolls Brutus up for the win and the big pop. Beefcake, after the match, hangs Kid in the tree of woe and kicks away until Davey makes a save. It was a fun match. It had some really hard-hitting offense. The crowd was locked in. I thought Beefcake looked sharp, and think of how far he's come in a year. We think back to that pre-WrestleMania 1 stuff we watched. You know, that time was spent with Valentine has paid off. He's still not great, but he is in a much better place than he was. Dynamite crisp and flawless as always. And I thought it was a fun match. It keeps a feud brewing. And I thought it was smart to put Beefcake with Dynamite because you could sell for him and, you know, just work a little bit sharper. I think Davey and Beefcake might have been a bit of a clunker. So I go 2.5 on this. I dug it. I thought it was one of Beefcake's best showings to date from a singles point of view, Scott.
Yeah, JR, they definitely did the right combos tonight because Beefcake needed somebody to kind of help hold his hand, and Davey Boy, that's not his job. Your match time, I don't know if you remember seeing it, JR. How long do you think it was?
I feel like it was kind of shorter, 12.
What do you think, Kel?
Oh, 10?
Pretty close, 11:18.
Yeah. I'd say it didn't 11, feel 18. That long. It felt like it didn't go long.
Yeah, 11:18. I thought the match was fine. I think, you know, Beefcake has had to have learned something during this run with the Hammer, who's an MVP of the world in my eyes. He really worked hard here, and he put Beefcake in a good spot to succeed, even if he didn't win the match. Beefcake has a basic moveset that's slowly growing over time. And a guy like Dynamite can kind of, you know, fit that spot in, fit that moveset in, and enhance it to make it look like more than it really is. And I think that's what's worked in this match. I do like the fact that they're kind of sticking with the Dream Team. You don't want to dump them too soon. Got to keep that going, that they could legitimately maybe win the belts back.
Yeah, definitely.
So I have no problem with that. And, I agree with you, JR. We're kind of in symmetry tonight. I also gave this match, 2.5 stars. I wanted to give it 3. I almost gave it 3.
Yeah.
If we were doing quarters, I would have given it 2.75.
Yeah.
That's how much I liked it. I thought Beefcake really, it's one of his best solo showings. Yes, the opponent didn't hurt, but I still think he's learning. He's definitely learning more than we thought he did. And I was impressed here. So 2.5. And I give Beefcake some credit for those stars, not just Dynamite. What do you think, Cal?
Yeah, this was a good one. I mean, especially when you watch the first 4 matches and nothing's going on. And then yes. Suddenly Dynamite Kid's in the ring, and it's just, holy fuck. You know,
this felt like Flair and Steamboat from 89 compared to the first 4 matches.
Exactly. I mean, Dynamite was so, so good at this time. So fast. Crisp, everything just looked good. Johnny V was wearing a Texas Rangers jersey. That was random.
Skin tight, so skin tight.
Like. Skin tight. Did he think it was the New York Rangers? Because he's from New York. I mean,
maybe. Maybe he bought it. That's what it was. I don't know.
It was an odd Jagas outside.
Well, because he usually wears Yankee stuff. You know what I mean? So it's not like he's a Texas Rangers. He must have thought it was a Rangers hockey shirt.
I think he thought it was a New York Rangers hockey. Same colors, you know. So I think he was confused. super fast paced, like I said. Kid won with the flash roll up at the end. lightning pace. I gave it 2 stars. Maybe I should have went a bit higher, but this was of course by far the best match we've seen so far, and one of the better bouts of the night.
Yeah, and I agree with Sky. I think it was good to keep the Dream Team together, percolating and keeping them in the tag picture. You know, possibly having them rematch, and kind of exhaust things, because they've had really good matches with the Bulldogs, and it hasn't been a long feud. You know, they've wrestled a bunch, but it's only been about, you know, a month and a half or whatever. So there's still some gas, I think, in the tank to have the Dream Team get a shot again. So,
oh, for sure.
All right, speaking of championships, we head to our next match, which is for the Intercontinental title, and that is our champion, Randy Macho Man Savage, taking on Tito Santana, the former champ. Tito gets his rematch here. A great entrance for Savage and Liz, as usual, as he immediately comes off like a credible champ, as he's meant to be. Alfred talks about Savage's expertise in psyching out opponents, including using Liz. Savage uses Liz to shield from Tito off the bell, and Al says, she's a part of the jig. She's not being used. She knows what's up. Tito charges, and Savage drops Liz and goes right at Tito with strikes. Savage hammers away, but Tito comes back with a flurry and kicks away, as Al says the title was held with dignity when Tito had it. Savage goes outside, but Tito comes right at him, knocks him into the crowd. Savage recovers and shoves Tito to the post. Tito's slow climbing back in, as Ladd thinks he may have separated his shoulder. Savage is aggressive, sprinting up top and burying Tito with an axe blow for 2. Savage gets a gut-wrench suplex and a clothesline for 2 counts and then chokes away. Savage continues to control as Ladd explains the psychology of maximizing a 5-count to bend the rules. Savage pitches Tito to the floor and follows out, but Tito meets it with punches. Savage retakes control as they back in, but Tito blocks a suplex before Savage hits a neckbreaker for 2. Savage goes back to work and they head outside again. Savage tries to use a chair but then kicks him before heading to the top. But as he comes off, Tito holds up a chair and he flies into it. Gorilla says this is the first time that Savage has been caught during that move. The crowd rallies Tito as they head back inside as the challenger punches away angrily, which Ladd says is a mistake because he didn't go for a cover and he let his emotions take over. Savage escapes outside, but Tito meets him with an axe off the apron and they brawl in the aisle, and then Tito rams Savage into the announce table. Back inside, Tito heads up top and cracks Savage with a double axe and then goes for the figure 4, but Savage goes to the eyes to stop him. The match goes back to the floor again where they trade hard punches until Tito slings Savage to the post and busts him wide open. Tito heads back in as Liz tries to help Savage, who's gushing blood. The referee randomly, for some reason, now has a towel hanging out of the back of his pants. Did he have that before? I didn't notice it. Did like the trainer hand it to him to help with the blood?
Yeah, it appeared at some point during the match. Yeah. He didn't have it at first, that's for sure.
No, I don't think he had it at first.
Right, it's random. It's like all of a sudden it's in his pants. Yeah. Savage climbs his way back inside. Al and Gorilla give him credit for hanging in. Savage tries to come at Tito, but gets caught with some heavy right hands. Savage battles back, and they trade blows until Savage just decides to hit the referee and say, fuck it. Tito drills Savage with a great flying forearm to a big pop, but the ref is out cold. Tito wakes the ref and then slams Savage hard to the mat. But the ref is still not there to count him, so he tries again. Tito gets a roll-up. The referee recovers, but Savage rolls through and hooks the tights to steal the win. Tito works over Savage after the bell until Macho escapes to great heat. Gorilla wonders why the ref didn't DQ Savage there as well. I love the finish. I thought it was a great heel finish. Savage cheats his way again just when hope was lost. We've seen this heel acumen from him before. Last time he's in the figure 4 about to lose, just punch the ref. And now, you know, he does it again to save himself. So he's really just escaping by the skin of his teeth. Lots of strong fire here. The blood added to it. Savage's desperation to the finish was so good because he knew he was in trouble and he keeps his wits about him. Tito looked great as well. I thought it was a really fun match, but I can't sit here and say it's their best because we've seen better recently. So I went just 3 stars on this. I felt like it was a little short and it was a little slower in spots, but it did have some really good stuff as always. And I did like the finish, but I may be low. I'm not sure. I'm curious what you guys have this at. What did you think, Kelly?
Well, yeah, I mean, I went 4 stars on this.
Okay. So it's me.
I mean, I've seen it numerous times. You know, it's no disqualification. So they used that stip really well, especially Savage cheating openly, and he can do that because, you know, he can't be disqualified.
Right.
Although
the announcers apparently forgot, but I'll get to that in a minute.
Yeah, totally. Yeah, that's the thing I was about to mention. Yeah, like Monsoon and Hayes didn't get the memo that was no DQ, but Fink clearly announced it beforehand that it was no DQ. And, of course, the way the match plays out, it was definitely a no DQ. Super heated. I watched the match from March you know, a week or two ago, and that was really good too. This one ups it a notch, though. We got blood, chairs, brawling on the outside, you know, right at the beginning, like the ref's holding Tito back, like Tito's just frothing at the mouth, wanting to get at Savage, you know, Savage attacks. He's still got his glasses and headband on, you know, chaos right from the beginning. Tito's just, it's a typical Tito blood feud, mm-hmm. Matt, where he's super hot.
It's that hot Latino blood flowing through.
Yes. Yeah. You know, I love the stuff with the chair at first, you know, Savage tossed into the crowd and then he's hit with a chair. And then later, Tito hit Savage with a chair when he was coming off with the double hacks handle on the outside. I thought that was a great spot. Really well timed. The brawling on the outside was great. Tito came off the top rope at one point, which is actually super rare for Tito to do. Usually never goes right to the top rope and comes off. The crowd was on fire at this point. Savage was busted open. Liz, I loved how she's running around, like super concerned. Mm-hmm. You know, she was really energized tonight too. The referee was a total idiot. the usual. Towel... Yes, as usual. Like, this was another one of those random, I think, athletic commission refs, maybe. I'm not sure. They seem lost. The towel making an appearance. Yeah, this is like he was like 30 years ahead of his time with being concerned about blood in a match.
It was like show, and he doesn't ever use it. It's just hanging from his back pocket. It's like they gave it to him to help so he could use it. He goes, fuck it. I'm just going to stick it in my pocket. They don't need it. It was random.
Maybe that is what happened. Because I missed where it got introduced. It suddenly he just had it.
Yeah. I don't see. Yeah, he just got it in his pocket. Someone must have handed it to him after the blood started. But
yeah, probably. The finish. Yeah, it was a great heel finish, like you said, JR. Because Savage wins with a handful of tights. The referee was knocked out by Savage himself, which made it even better. So he was loopy when he came around to count the pin, and you know, I'm not going to spoil what's coming up, but the finish does play into the next match between these two perfectly. Mm-hmm. So it was booked really good, and yeah, I thought this was a sensational match. 4 stars. I think this is the fourth 4-star match I have given, and I love both guys, and yeah, great match.
Yeah, I actually graded it. I went right in between both you guys. I gave it 3.5. Savage, I did like, the only good thing that the announcers did was I kind of liked that Alfred kind of went off script and thought that Elizabeth was actually a deliberately good heel manager, even though we know she's clearly not. But I kind of liked that Alfred at least attempted to change the narrative about it. So I'll give Alfred credit for that. But otherwise, Ernie Ladd was fantastic at this match, comparing him to like Ali and Foreman and all the boxing, you know, vernacular. And he was great in this match. But Gorilla and Alfred, I mean, why don't you just say, well, in our opinion, only Tito should have the no DQ step. I mean, it's like, stop whining. It gets out of control. Even for 1986 standards, it's getting out of control. I mean, first of all, Fink clearly said this is a no disqualification match. Yet constantly shoves the rope. Oh, he should be DQ'd anyway. Doesn't matter about the stip. I mean, guys, grow up. I mean, really, we're not all that dumb. I mean, I know it's again, I know it's 1986, but let's really think about this. He'd said no DQ. So instead of Tito, and Tito did a lot in this match. I think the spot of the night for me was the one where Savage, you know, did his top rope to the floor, and Tito actually caught him with a chair. That was a fantastic spot. Because you don't see it a lot. Even Gorilla acknowledges that's the first time Savage has ever gotten caught. And I think he has. That's the first time he did get caught. The match was fantastic. But this and I know Savage, you know, he's a heel. I get that. There's only so far you can go before you start sounding like a real idiot. And Gorilla and Alfred in this match just sounded so dumb. So dumb. I understand the stip. And I understand you gotta trash the heel and all that, but to say, oh, the ref should DQ him anyway, I mean, well, it's such a crybaby. It's not, now you're just getting out of hand, and that's why I liked the most about Ernie Ladd on the show. He kept them level-headed, kept the, you know, things very leveled out and really had good analysis about two guys bludgeoning each other. The blood was great. Everything was a great package of two good wrestlers who, and again, this is another chapter of a feud that not many people remember, you know, at face value.
Mm-hmm.
Everyone thinks, well, Tito lost on February 8th and then Savage moved on to George Steele and then other guys. No, this Tito feud went on for a couple months and it was one great match after another. But the announcers tonight were just so incorrigible. I mean, it was just getting, it was embarrassing that they're just complaining that this is no, either they forgot, which is even worse. I'd rather they act like they're ignoring it than to realize that they didn't even know. That's worse. But I understand Savage is the heel, but the stips for everybody. So if anything, you should be complaining that Tito's not going that extra mile. But he did. And the chair shot in the throat practically proved that. So announcing faux pas aside, this match is tremendous. I wouldn't say it's 4 stars, Kel, but I would say definitely JR higher than 3. So I'll go right down the middle and say 3.5. Because Savage can't do anything less than 3 right now. He is totally on fire right now. Mm-hmm. And this is what's making me love our new reboot, because we've said for years about that Savage didn't figure it out till WrestleMania 3. And well, he still did some stalling things and mostly other nondescript TV matches, but I'm finally realizing that at least on these house shows, he's starting to figure out that you got to tell a different story than when you're on national TV. So this was like the first chapter or the beginnings of Savage starting to figure out the WWF style and being really adept to it is in this regional. Because I've been watching house shows from Boston. I've been watching house shows from the Spectrum, Maple Leaf Gardens, in this 4 or 5 month stretch. And Savage is just getting it on the regional scale. Now he just needs to get it on the national scale. And unfortunately, he hasn't had anything to work with. I mean, I won't get into the George Steele match again. I trashed it enough on our last vault. So he's understanding now how to work this WWE style with these guys. And honestly, Tito has been amazing in helping him.
I don't know what this we is. I mean, you've been saying you've been stalling and didn't figure it out.
So suddenly, well, no. No.
Yeah.
No. That has been a common narrative for a very long time in pro wrestling, that it took a long time nationally for Savage to adapt to the WWF style. WrestleMania 2 proved that. A lot of the Saturday's main event matches proved that. And then the journey was complete when he got to Steamboat. We'll get to that down the line. But regionally, a lot of these house shows that a lot of us didn't watch at the time or did and forgot because we had a different frame of mind as a wrestling fan, he really picked up quicker than I remember the style of not walking around endlessly around. Because some of these Memphis matches are just dreadful in that aspect. And again, you probably had to grow up watching it to understand it. But not watching Prism or Nessun back then, you didn't get to see as much of this stuff. So you just watched his TV stuff, which was more attuned to stalling and, you know, hamming up the camera and the crowd in the front. Whereas regionally, because you got more time, you had to have longer matches, you had to do more than just stooge around the ring. Whereas on like a Saturday's main event or pay-per-view or something like that, you only had 5-6 minutes. So you did a lot of stooging to kill time, and then the match would end in a DQ or a countout or something stupid. But from a regional level where you have to have 6 or 7 more minutes to work, Savage kind of had to force himself to do more than just stooge around the ring with Elizabeth. What I'm saying is that now we're getting an opportunity that you may not have remembered before, that on a regional level where you have to wrestle more, Savage has been able to learn it and adapt to it quicker than we thought he did. And it's more Tito, who we didn't think had this feud going that long back then, but has, and it's the miracle of YouTube and everything now, that you can watch all these house shows and see how much he helped Savage even more after WrestleMania, or even after February 8th, when we thought that Tito was just cooked by then. And that's the miracle of Savage and Tito And that's why these matches continually get better and better and better. So, and the blood doesn't help, doesn't hurt either. So Savage retains his Intercontinental title in another fantastic match, 3.5 stars, and he trucks along. I don't know how much longer this goes. I'm curious to see if he, as we move along, how he, you know, Tito finally kind of moves off and Savage works his next guy before he gets to the real big feud, which of course we'll talk about in late summer. But speaking of belts, our next match involves a guy with a belt, although it is not on the line, JR. And who is it?
A lot of wheeze in there. Davey Boy Smith taking on Greg Valentine. Under that, wee is a little strong. Wee is a little strong. It's been a belief, a talking point for you for sure in a lot of these things. But I don't want to say it. I don't think that's a common thought amongst many out there. And I'm not saying you were wrong for thinking of it. I'm saying it's more of an exposure thing. I think it's maybe some people came to realization, but I don't think that's been a talking point that like widely spread. But it's for people like, you know, us that maybe didn't see as much stuff, I can understand it. But I just want to clarify what my point was to say. I don't think it's a huge common thought at this point. I think it's pretty much been disproven for when it exists.
And I'll say that over the last few years with more DVDs, because don't forget we haven't seen a lot of the Savage stuff we loved early on in his career didn't come to the mainstream for us until Vince kind of broke the fourth wall with him and allowed 2 DVD comps and more stuff on the network and things like that. All right, I can acquiesce to that. But in any event, the moral of the story is we're getting much better Savage than we thought we had at this stage of his WWF career, and that's a win for everybody. So fair enough there. Speaking of awesome workers, we're about to talk about two others right now.
And that is Davey Boy Smith taking on Greg Valentine. Of course, that's second half for a tag title feud. Davey looks huge as always. We get a feeling out that ends up with Hammer rolling up Davey for 2. Davey reverses a whip and wallops Hammer with a hard clothesline that sends him outside. Hammer slides back in and hooks Davey in the corner and lays into him with punches and chops. Davey comes back and clubs away for 2 and then works the arm. Davey catches Hammer with a dropkick and takes him down and turns him into a scorpion deathlock, which Gorilla says he's not sitting back on enough. Davey starts to work the legs, stretching out the groin and hamstrings. Hammer slides to the apron and trades 2 suplex attempts, which Davey wins. And then Valentine goes up top, taking Valentine up and into the ring for 2 count. Hammer recovers and chops away before laying in some stiff elbows for a near fall. Hammer goes up top, but Davey slams him for 2. Ladd says Hammer learned how to go deep into matches and not wear down. And that was like a unique way of saying the whole, like, he doesn't get warmed up for a while. Like, you always hear it that way. This was like an actual different way for someone to say it. Davey gets a small package for 2. Hammer recovers and kicks him to the floor and follows out with a forearm off the apron. Hammer runs Davey to the railing and then back inside. Hammer gets a nice suplex and drops a hard hammer blow for 2. Hammer works the neck with a chin lock and a vice, but Davey punches free. Hammer keeps control and goes to a front face lock, and they tussle in that hold for a minute with a nice battle of strength. Ladd talks about the psychology of that hold as Hammer releases it and levels Davey with a hard clubbing blow. Hammer drops a knee to the chest for 2 and goes back to the chin lock, but Davey breaks it down with a back suplex for a soft 2 count. Davey drops Hammer with the running power slam to a pop and 2. Hammer slides outside and Davey follows and chases, but Hammer kicks Davey when he comes back in, and Hammer grabs the figure 4. Davey gets to the ropes to force the break and then blocks 2 more figure 4s and then shoots Hammer hard to the corner. Hammer scales the middle rope and hits a hard hammer blow to the back of the neck for the win. Stiff, hard-hitting, smartly worked match, really well executed, and I like the finish because it paid off all the work on the neck that they had going on. And it also keeps the feud alive because now we split on the night and the Dream Team at least evens things up. They didn't get squashed here. It was a fun, strong, stiff battle. I went with 3 stars. I enjoyed it just as much as Savage Tito, and I think it was a notch better than Dynamite Beefcake's Cup.
Yes, your time, I don't know if I gave the time, the Tito Savage time was 12:16, which was fantastic. This was 9:12. We're going to talk about another tremendous worker, so there's no doubt there. I gave this 3 stars, again, a notch below Savage Tito, but another guy who just gets it. One of the greatest storytellers of all time in a match, regardless of what anyone thinks of the 40 minutes. Greg Valentine knows what the fuck he's doing. He's always thought that. And the more I watch these house shows and seeing what he did, I'm almost more impressed in the Dream Team than when he was Intercontinental Champion. He just knows what he's doing. And Davey Boy, obviously, the talent gap between Dynamite and Davey Boy is a little smaller than the talent gap between Savage, between Valentine and Beefcake. So it's not like, you know, Davey Boy Smith's the hack that was given to Valentine. That's why this match is better than Dynamite and Beefcake is. But again, Hammer just knows, based on a guy in the ring, what to do. And Davey Boy, obviously not as, you know, nimble as Dynamite is, but two power guys who know how to hit, who know how to take advantage of their strengths of striking. And I think Valentine winning was a highlight of the night for me. I may nominate it for my moment of the night later, because again, I like the fact that they're keeping the Dream Team in your frame of vision as a contender to win back the tag straps instead of just dismissing them. So that I loved as well. But the match worked so well. Valentine literally has made everybody look good, all three. Even Dynamite, who doesn't really need to look good, but it doesn't hurt to have a guy in there with him to enhance his abilities. He has owned this whole feud, my opinion, from beginning to end. Owned it. Helped his own guy and helped make those other guys better, top to bottom. And the fact that Valentine won was great. When I say surprising, I was taken aback for a moment because I really thought that they were just going to, you know, step the gas on the Bulldogs rocket ship and just move on. But no, I was very impressed that they had Valentine win to keep them strong. So three stars for me. Tremendous match and another good job by Hammer to tell a good story in the ring against a guy that, you know, maybe need a little help writing his side of it. What'd you think, Kel?
Yeah, I like this one. I went 2.5. I think for me, with this match and with the Dynamite Beefcake match, the reason I'm kind of rating them lower is there's a lack of importance. Like, I know this was part of like a bigger story, but, you know, there wasn't a title on the line here. It's not part of like a blood feud per se. So couldn't get super behind it. But I mean, the work is really good. Valentine's great as always, and Davey Boy was really good. And a big plus in their favor is that the crowd was hot for this match, coming off a big time match with Savage and Santana. So usually, you know, the crowd would be kind of quiet coming off a hot match like that. But no, they were hot for everything that was going on here in a tough spot following a match like that. I thought it slowed down a bit in the middle after a really good start, but it picked up at the end. I liked, you know, the whole figure four spot and with Smith selling the leg. And then the finish was cool because Hammer won clean, basically, with a forearm off the top rope. He didn't have to cheat, which is rare for a heel to pick up a win at this point in time in WWF. So, yeah, definitely a good match.
Hammer seems to get that respect. I feel like he's the guy that, when they do have a heel win clean or get that hard-fought win, it seems to be him that gets a spot. Like, you knew looking, if you would have said going in that these matches are going to be split, I mean, you would have bet on Valentine all day that he was going to be the one to get the win. And that's just how the Dream Team was orchestrated and built. So I was glad he got the win. I mean, even if it's the end of the road for the Dream Team, it sets him up to get back rolling again as a singles eventually. So I liked it a lot. I thought it was a good, well-booked and well-set-up night for these two teams, because I do want to see them keep going, and I think it is important to don't have the Dream Team get completely, you know, mulched again here after losing a 2, because even a 2, it was barely a win. You know, it's not like the Bulldogs dominated them, so the Dream Team's hung in here. They're portrayed as equals, and I think they've done a nice job continuing that tonight. So
there's no doubt about that.
Yeah. All right, Scott, you want to take a little break ski here.
So why don't we it's time for intermission, time for us to go to the concession stands or the waitresses come to the suites. Kel, what do you think so far? Thumbs up, thumbs down, in the middle?
Well,
all three of them?
Yeah, definitely not thumbs down, and thumbs up would be a bit too strong considering the way we started with those first four matches or so. But I mean, one of the best matches that we've seen so far, in my opinion, anyway, with Savage and Santana. So, yeah, I'll say middle.
Okay. JR? Not bad so far for you?
Yeah, about the same. These last three have been pretty good. I mean, even being a little bit lower on Savage Santana, I still think it was really, you know, I liked it. I liked it. So I think these three, the Bulldogs matches and the Tito Savage, that's quite a run of three to make up for the garbage we had earlier. So we'll see how we finish. I mean, we're teetering now. You know, the rest of the show is going to make or break things.
Yes. Well, we got a few matches left, but we'll take a break. When we come back, we've got a big main event, and I mean big. And maybe a couple others that, you know, may, like you said, may make or break this from being a show that's 6 out of 10 to a show that's, you know, 3.5 out of 10. But first, let's get some any words on everything and anything. Because...
Promotional consideration paid for by the following.
Hey, pro wrestling announcer Kevin Kelly here. I want to make sure you are all subscribed to all the great feeds here at Place to Be Nation. It's really easy to do. Just head to iTunes or your preferred podcatcher app today and search and subscribe to the Place to Be Nation wrestling feed, which, of course, includes the full archives of the Kevin Kelly Show, the Place to Be Nation pod feed, and the pro wrestling only feed. Subscribe, listen, and then rate us and leave feedback today. And be sure to give Justin your true thoughts. I mean, don't hold back. After all, he is kind of a jerk. Just listen to Scott.
Place to Be Nation's JT Rosero here, and I want to let you know that we have a ton of great podcasts available to you on iTunes, Stitcher, Google Play, and PlayStation.com, and we now offer them to you on two great feeds. On the Place to Be Nation wrestling feed, you can check out Scott Criscolo and me on the Mothership, the Place to Be podcast, with our famous Vintage Vault pay-per-view reviews. PTBN also covers current-day wrestling with Clotheslines and Headlines, Main Event, Lucha Afterground, and our monthly pay-per-view reaction shows. And we leave wrestling's past with our monthly pay-per-view rewind series led by Ben Morse, the Our Vantage Point podcast, which features a potpourri-style look at wrestling history, and Survey Says, a fun look back at the good, bad, and ugly of WCW. And on our very popular Place to Be Nation Pop podcast feed, we offer such great shows as the Glenn Butler podcast, Our Spectacular, Rank and File, PTBN Dadcast, NBA Team, and Lucha Undead, as well as a veritable podcast heaven for comics fans with hard-traveling fanboys, Sellers Points, Todd Weber's Conversations, Geek and Sassy, and the Imaginary Stories. You can find all these current shows plus archives of our past podcasts, including The Kevin Kelly Show, as well by subscribing to both feeds on iTunes. And while there, be sure to rate and leave feedback as well. All these shows plus others available at PlayStation.com, where we cover pro wrestling, sports, movies, comics, plus tournaments and more. Be sure to support our site by using PlayStation.com/Amazon when doing your online shopping, and download our free PTB Vintage Vault Refresh ebooks via the links on our site. We also want to thank our friends at Bonehead's Wing Bar in West Warwick, Rhode Island, in Fall River, Massachusetts, thehistoryofwrestling.com, and Scott Keith's Blog of Doom. Be sure to follow us on Facebook, Twitter, Instagram, and Tumblr as well. PlaceToBeNation.com, the only place to be in your pop culture world.
The Pro Wrestling Only Podcast Network. Subscribe on iTunes or on Android with your favorite podcast app. Established in 2013, the Pro Wrestling Only Podcast Network is committed to providing unique takes on the rich and diverse medium of professional wrestling, focusing on its history and global impact, but also exploring the vibrant contemporary scene. The roll call includes Space City, an NWA On Demand podcast, This Week in Wrestling, Stacy and Elliott's Bogus Journey, the Super Apoitas podcast, the Military Industrial Suplex, Strong Style History, Puro Puri, and Psychology is Dead. Also, from the archives, the full catalog of great shows that provided a fresh look at classic wrestling, including Where the Big Boys Play, Titans of Wrestling, Tag Teams Back Again, Letters from Kayfabe, Wrestling Culture, Pro Wrestling Super Show, Goodwill Wrestling, and many, many others. Pro Wrestling Only Podcast Network. Only the best.
Hey, this is the King of the Mountain, Jeff Jarrett, the founder and president of Global Force Wrestling, and you're listening to the Place to Be podcast.
All right, Nathan, we are back looking at the April 1986 Madison Square Garden house show. And, of course, as we mentioned earlier, we're just 2 weeks removed from the big wedding of Kelly Nelson. And, of course, the highlight of that whole event was the kiss that steals the deal. And speaking of kisses, Scott Criscolo, I believe that's the music playing underneath us tonight. And it's getting me in a romantic mood here talking some MSG wrestling. And it got me all, you know, all lathered up for your pop culture corner. Can you take us into that and help me cool down a bit?
Yes, but if you have to cool down thinking about you, Kel. But,
I like Kelly a lot.
Well, we all like Kelly a lot. Let's go to Toots. Yes, the number one song this week. Actually, of course, the countdown came out that previous Saturday the 19th. This is a Tuesday night, actually, house show, not a Monday night. This is a Tuesday. So it came out on the 19th, and Kiss by Prince and the Revolution is your number one song. Moving up a couple spots to number two, Manic Monday by the Bangles. I think it's the first time we've actually mentioned the Bangles. Number three, Addicted to Love by Robert Palmer. Number four, the former number one, Rock Me D'Amato. Rock Me D'Amato, D'Amato. Of course, Rock Me Amadeus by Falco. Number five, The West End Girls by the Pet Shop Boys. Number six, I think it's our first taste of a little In Excess with What You Need at number six. Number seven, Let's Go All the Way by Sly Fox. Number eight, The Harlem Shuffle by the Pet Shop Boys. So the Pet Shop Boys actually had two songs in the... Oh, I'm sorry. Harlem Shuffle is Rolling Stones. Sorry. I thought I was going to say Pet Shop Boys had two top tens. I'm a little crazy. Harlem Shuffle by the Rolling Stones. I never even heard of that song. Number nine, the first top ten, guy to my right will be happy about this, of the Van Hagar era, Why Can't This Be Love by Van Halen, coming off the 5150 album. And number 10, Tender Love by the Force MDs. So there is your top 10, Billboard top 10. So Prince, God rest his soul, is at the top of the heap this week.
Heap of trash. That's not surprising, number one.
There was a lot of crap underneath that. The previous Friday,
like the
JR.
It's like the show we've been talking about. Two good songs on top and then a whole bunch of garbage opening up for it.
Yes. Speaking of garbage, I'm sure there's a few movies I'm going to throw at you that are pretty lousy anyway. Five movies came out the previous Friday, JR.
Okay.
One of them is actually a pretty well-known adventure film, fantasy adventure film that came out in the 80s. We'll get to that in a minute. All right, first up, you ready?
Mm-hmm.
The first one is a musical. It made $930,211 called Absolute Beginners. Not very creative title there.
Absolute Beginners. It's a David Bowie song and a film. British rock musical adapted from Colin McGinnis's book of the same name about life in 1950s London. The film takes place in 1958, a time which pop culture is transforming from 1950s jazz and early rock to new generation on the verge of the 60s. London in a post-World War II but pre-Beatles Stones. The storyline incorporates the elements of 1958 Notting Hill race riots. Patsy Kinsett, Eddie O'Connell, David Bowie, James Fox, Ray Davies, Mandy Rice Davies, Tony Hippolyte, Joe McKenna, and many others that we don't know star in this film.
Okay. Bowie had a busy decade on the silver screen.
Mm-hmm.
Okay, coming in fourth, a drama, which made $2.347 million. I think I remember this movie. It is called At Close Range.
Okay, let's check that out.
I see that title on a VHS box for some reason.
Yeah, definitely. It's a crime. You're just looking at the cover makes you think that. It's an American crime drama film based on the real-life rural Pennsylvania crime family led by Bruce Johnston Sr. that operated between the 60s and 70s. Brad Whiteward Sr., the leader of an organized crime family, one night his estranged oldest son, Brad Jr., contacts him after a fight with his mother's boyfriend and stays at his home in Holmville, Pennsylvania. He eventually becomes involved in his father's criminal activities and starts a gang with his half-brother, Tommy. The boys attempt a daring heist, which results in their arrest, and all of them are bailed out except Brad Jr. Sean Penn is Brad Jr., Christopher Walken as the father, Mary Stewart, Masterson, Chris Penn, Millie Perkins, Aline, Riley, Ryan, Tracy Walter, anyone else? Crispin Glover is in this. Noelle Parker, in At Close Range.
And I believe we may see another Madonna song come up in our Billboard charts in the next couple of shows because a well-known Madonna song came from this soundtrack. So,
Kiefer Sutherland was also in this. Kiefer Sutherland was also in this movie. And Eileen Ryan is the Penn's real-life mother, so the whole fucking family was in this movie, apparently.
Tommy, like Tommy Nielsen. All right, so there's your fourth. That's right. Mr. Reigns. All right, at number three, it is a comedy, more mafia apparently, a comedy that made $8,475,466. It is called Wise Guys. Tell me this is going to be a terrible mafia parody.
Let's see. A black mafia comedy crime film. Italian-American Harry Valentini and his Jewish friend and next-door neighbor Mo Dickenstein occupy the bottom rung of the Newark mafia boss Anthony Costello's gang. Mo Dickstein, making a living by doing Costello's lowest jobs. The two men dream of opening the world's first Jewish-Italian delicatessen, but they get no respect from their boss or subordinates, who completely and frequently ridicule them. The cast, Danny DeVito, Joe Piscopo, our buddy, Harvey Keitel, Ray Sharkey, Dan Hedaya, everyone knows him, Lou fucking Albano.
Yeah, Lou Albano's in that movie.
Acavano. Patty LuPone, Matthew Kay. My lord, there's a million people in this fucking movie. Not going to read them all. Anyone else of interest? No, that's about it. Joe Piscopo. There you go. Wise
I think
guys.
D'Amato should check into the Rumble Hotel under the name Mo Dickstein.
Yes.
Hey, Mo Dickstein! All right. The number two movie of the weekend, an action film, made $9,947,631. It is called Murphy's Law.
Okay.
Sounds like another VHS specialty right here.
For sure. Film here, 1986 thriller film. Jack Murphy, of course, a hardened antisocial LAPD detective, frequently escapes the harsh reality that his ex-wife has become a stripper and his career is going nowhere by drinking. His world is turned upside down, however, when he's framed by ex-convict Joan Freeman for putting her in prison earlier in his career. Charles Bronson is Jack Murphy. Carrie Snodgrass is Joan. Richard Romanus, Angel Tompkins, and that's about it. Lawrence Tierney. Nothing much going on in Murphy's Law.
Charles Bronson. All right.
Sounds like a Bronson
special. And the
number
one.
Movie.
Yeah. A lot of good actors, just not a lot of good movies. And the number one movie of the weekend, this was definitely one of the more memorable ones of the decade for like children's sci-fi fantasy. It made $15,502,112. It lost money, though, because I think it was worth $25 million. It is called Legend. You remember this movie, Cal?
I think so.
I think it's another Bowie. Or is that Labyrinth? No, that was Labyrinth.
No, this is isn't Tom Cruise in this one?
Yes, an American-British dark fantasy adventure film. It was released in Britain in 1985, December, then the U.S. in April. Once long ago, the ancient Lord of Darkness laments his isolation in the shadows before sensing the presence of two unicorns who safeguard the power of the light, whereupon darkness instructs Blix and Hill, its fellow goblins Pox and Blunder. So this movie must be about 6 hours. To kill the unicorns and bring their horns to free himself. Meanwhile, Princess Lily, a mischievous and vibrant girl, goes alone to the forest to meet her love interest, Jack. Tom Cruise is Jack, Mia Sara is Princess Lily, Tim Curry, Alice Playton, Billy Barty, Cork Hubbard, and Robert Picardo.
So they spent the movie reading police reports and forensic files.
Yeah, pretty much.
All right.
So and there's asking your, himself and answering his own questions for a half hour.
Yes. So there you go. So there's the five movies that came out the previous Friday. All right. Let's hit sports real quick. Major League Baseball. We are a few weeks into the 1986 season. Let's see how our teams did. The New York Yankees, JR, 5-1 winners in Kansas City over the defending world champion Royals. Mm. Guess who got the win? Take a shot in the dark.
Reggie Jackson.
This is 1986, not 1970. He wasn't even on the team in 76.
Wasn't Tanaka. I know that.
No, it's not Tanaka.
I don't know. Dave Rigetti.
Bob Tewksbury.
Oh, okay. Bob Tewksbury.
Oh, wow.
There you go. And Dave Rigetti got his fourth save. The Mets were 7-1 winners at home against the Pirates. Bob Ojeda got the win. And Mr. Nelson, the Blue Jays. Oh, how the mighty have fallen. Blown out at home, 10-1 by the Rangers.
Oof.
What do you
the
think
New York Rangers or the Texas
Johnny
Rangers?
Johnny B's favorite team.
I need to see the shirt to know which team.
Yes. Who do you think took the loss for the Blue Jays?
10-1. Well, I hope it wasn't Steve or
it was
Jimmy.
Dave Steeb. Dave Steeb is too awesome to lose 10-1.
And hopefully not Jimmy Key either.
It was not Jimmy Key.
Who else did they have at that time? I don't know.
Jim Clancy.
Oh, Clancy, right.
Yes, Bobby Witt got the win. The standings at the moment, the Yankees lead the AL East at 9-4. The Blue Jays are the Blue Jays are 6-8. In the AL West, the Angels at 9-6 with a half game lead over the A's. Mets and Cardinals tied in the NL East at 7-3. And in the NL West, the Giants lead at 10-4. The Astros are a half game back at 9-4. The NBA, let's see. Yes, the NBA playoffs are in full swing. I'm not going to go through all the rounds. We'll just go through the teams that played on this date. We'll begin in the Western Conference. Let's see. Game 3 at Arco Arena in Sacramento. Rockets completed a three-game sweep of the Kings, 113-98.
Suck it, Todd Weber.
Yeah. Game 3 at the
Coliseum. Is he going to blame the refs for that one, too? Did they fuck them over in that one?
Everybody got paid off, yeah, man. Yeah. Game 3 in Portland, the Nuggets beat the Trailblazers 115-104. They lead that series 2-1. And those are the only games in the Western Conference. In the East, at Chicago Stadium, the defending Eastern Conference champion Celtics completed a three-game sweep of the Bulls, 122-104. But guys, it was 2 days earlier at the Boston Garden. Of course, everyone remembers this was the beginning of what would be the legacy of one of the greatest players ever. That was the game that Michael Jordan scored 63 points. But the Celtics won in double overtime anyway and then completed the sweep tonight, April 22nd, in Chicago. Also another sweep completed at the Brendan Byrne Arena at the Meadowlands. The Bucks beat the Nets 118-113 to sweep that series in three straight games. Also, at the Cap Center in Landover, Sixers beat the Bullets 91-86. They lead that series 2-1. And at the Pontiac Silverdome, the Pistons beat the Hawks 106-97. They trail that series still, though, 2-1. So there's a quick update on what was going on in the NBA playoffs. Stanley Cup playoffs, Mr. Nelson will be quite pleased.
Yes.
With what went on this date. We were in the, I think we were in the conference finals of the 1986.
Division finals.
Division. Were we in the division finals?
I can tell you all about this series, man.
Yes, we were in the division finals, yes. Both games on this date were in the Western Conference. At the Maple Leaf Gardens, Kelly's other team, the Maple Leafs, they beat the Blues 5-2, so you could say suck it, Pete. But the Maple Leafs lead the series 2-1. And yes, also on this evening at the Saddle Dome in Calgary, the Flames beat the Oilers 3-2 to take a 2-1 lead in that series. There's your update on NHL and the NHL playoffs.
That's a legendary series if you're a Calgary Flames fan.
Well, of course it is.
The Oilers had won 2 straight cups. The Flames are an up-and-coming team. This was actually the birth of my sports fandom, this series. Like, before that, you know, I'm Canadian, so of course hockey's always there, but I really hadn't rooted for anyone before this, and it goes 7 games, spoiler alert, and the Flames win game 7 in Edmonton on an own goal. Steve Smith scores on his own net. That's like a legendary moment in hockey history, Canadian hockey history. And it propelled the Flames onto, they beat the Blues in the conference finals. And then,
we're going to find that out over the next couple weeks. What the hell?
Just stop.
Okay.
I wait with bated breath to see what's going to happen in these sports reports.
Okay. Yeah. I'm getting too excited because it's such a huge.
Yeah.
I know. It's been 30 years since you've had any enjoyment as a hockey fan. So it's okay.
The only time they ever beat the Oilers in the playoffs. And yes. The Oilers, I'll stop there.
But you could say that they won the series because by the time we get to the next house show, the series. Over. So
we're gonna say that, and finally, we're gonna say that for the new podcast, Justin Learns Hockey. Me and you, Kelly. We're gonna go chronologically through Stanley Cup playoffs.
Oh sure, maybe.
And finally, we have a birthday today. On this date, April 22nd, 1986, this NFL running back was born. I will give you 3 hints. He is a running back. There's your hint number 1. Hint number 2: he does have a ring. And hint number 3: he is currently on the Oakland Raiders. Any guesses?
Lamont JR. Jordan.
Where would Lamont Jordan have won a ring?
In my mind, with the Jets in 1998. Marshawn Lynch. Yep.
That is correct. Mr. Fugly himself, Marshawn Lynch, was born on this date, April 22nd, 1986. There you go. And that is your sports report brought to you by Kelly's autobiography, Me and My Lanny Mustache. All right, back to the garden. And the announcers, JR, kind of sit around a little, take a breather, no backstage interviews, but the three gentlemen, Gorilla, Alfred, and the Big Cat, kind of recap WrestleMania 2, kind of give the viewers a little recap of what happened 15 days earlier.
Yeah, they talk about the greatness of MSG as well, and then, yes, they share their thoughts on what went down at Mania. And then we head to our next match, which is the other half of the Foreign Legion, the Iron Sheik, battling Corporal Kirchner, our old pal, still trying to figure it out, trying to piece things together and, you know, deliver on that promise we see in him. A continuation of the Corporal's issues with the Legion. Blassie and Nikolai come out to ringside as well. We get good heat on Sheik while Corporal gets a solid reaction and lots of USA chants. I didn't know if this was a rib or a shot at Kirchner or if it was just Alfred, like, using phrasing that sounded like it. He goes, nobody gets as high for his matches as Corporal Kirchner. So I don't know if he was like trying to say like he's a fucking junkie or something. He's out there high. Like the way he says it, like with extra emphasis on high. So I didn't know. Or if it was just like Al being Al. Corporal has no music this month, which I thought hurt the atmosphere a bit. Sheik jumps Kirchner as he gets in the ring, beats on him before the bell, and chokes with his headdress. The bell finally rings as Sheik takes Corporal over with a backdrop and spits on him to booze, flipping off the crowd as well. Kirchner recovers and slams Sheik and then drops an elbow and looks a bit confused before dragging Sheik to the corner and yanking his nuts into the post. Ladd questions the work here, saying, you injured the neck, why are you switching to the legs? Gorilla says he's young and he gets by on guts. Al says he's so hyped up he doesn't know what he's doing besides just attacking someone. Kirchner gets a suplex for two and then a gut-wrench suplex for another near fall. Kirchner whiffs on a dropkick and Ladd said that was a high-risk move and it destroyed all the work he did. I love that Ernie Ladd thinks a dropkick is a high-risk maneuver. That's fantastic, like, snapshot of his time when he was a worker. Sheik goes to the goes back to work with a nice gut-wrench for two and then grabs an abdominal stretch. Kirchner breaks out with a hip toss and drops an elbow as Ladd credits the fans for fueling him. Kirchner gets a sunset flip for two and shoulder blocks Sheik down awkwardly. Sheik starts to pray as Gorilla says the sun must be going down somewhere. And it was a brilliant move because it baits Kirchner in and then Sheik yanks him by the pants to the floor. And out there, Nikolai beats on Kirchner with a cane. Sheik rolls back in and gets the count-out win. Another count-out here tonight. Volkov pitches Kirchner back inside and they beat him up until he sneaks free and grabs a chair. Again, fine. Decent heat. A bit sloppy and hard-hitting. At the same time, I thought the finish was cool. I love Sheik baiting him in right when he was in trouble. Kirchner's still clunky, but it kind of worked in an odd way. And I want to start here. I enjoyed Sheik's work. I always enjoy Sheik in these matches. And, you know, Kirchner brought a little bit of energy, too. What'd you think, Kelly?
Yeah, I love Sheik, but, I mean, I don't love Corporal Kirchner. There's just no heat for him. Nobody cares. 2 years earlier at MSG... was Sheik against Slaughter, you know, and that in matches that tore the house down. And here we go, 2 years later, this is supposed to be kind of, you know, trying to recapture the magic of that, and there's just no magic at all. Listeners at home can play a drinking game for this card, and anytime you see someone give a sunset flip, have a drink, because there's a lot of sunset flips on this show.
I feel like we don't get, you know, it's funny because for this time period, you always think of a lot of countouts to protect guys and whatnot, but I feel like we haven't had that many countouts, really. I guess the Hogan Savage stuff, but that was for a purpose. But two on this night's pretty unique, I feel like, for this run that we're on.
Yeah. No, and Kirchner definitely had, you know, the bloom was off the rose for him. I'm not sure if the lack of music and Al's quip about him being high have anything, you know, to do with it. But, you know, he's definitely kind of he hasn't had a meaningful win, really. I mean, yeah, he beat Volkov at WrestleMania, but that wasn't anything really. It was buried in the middle of the show and nothing too celebrated. It's definitely not going too well for him, and I went half a star on this. I just, Corporal Kirchner is a guy that I've seen a lot of him in recent years, just through like Mystery Titans Theater and here, and even in Stampede Wrestling he turns up in 1987. I watched some of that, and I just, every time I can't stand the guy. I think he's someone who just got into wrestling because he, you know, he had a good look and was maybe a bit athletic, but I don't think he had any real passion for wrestling, and it shows in his performances. Yeah.
Nobody gets as high as Corporal Crusher for a match as Corporal Crusher.
I think it was a rib, to be honest with you. This match is terrible.
I mean, Crusher looks baked out there anyway, so I mean, there's a good
chance. Well, that's true, too. Yeah. And he was cooked in terms of his in-ring, too. Yes. Yeah, I gave this a star, mostly because I love the Sheik. Sheiky baby. Your runtime is 4:56. Yeah, Kel, I mean, it's such a snapshot, right? Watch this match and then watch the boot camp from, what was it, June of 84, I think. It's fucking, it's night and day. I mean, it's not even close. Those matches, Slaughter and Sheik, were just so red hot. And this is just a mess. I think Kirshner was cooked. I think he's in that C.V. Afi camp of just failed experiments. It's not good. It's not good. He doesn't know what he's doing out there. He's in good shape. You know, he's got a decent physique, but he doesn't know what he's doing. He's starting to get, and now he's starting to get more. He won that flag match at Mania, but now he's starting to look more and more embarrassed by these guys. And, I'm getting the feeling, and you can tell by the commentary that they're kind of giving up on him too. There's nothing left for Kirshner. He's definitely in the CV Afi, dumpster pile camp of just useless trash. And it's a shame because, I mean, they did what they could. They, again, unlike CV Afi, which experiment tanked after one match, I mean, they gave Corporal Kirshner a decent amount of time. I mean, a good, 6 months? Dating back to, you know, maybe late October going into the Wrestling Classic. And I mean, they gave him a good amount of time. And maybe even more than that because, I remember his TNT segments were what, in the summertime? August?
Yeah.
So, I mean, they gave him a good, 9 months?
Yeah.
And it just didn't, it couldn't fly. It didn't fly.
Yeah. He had a really good look because he looked like Sylvester Stallone's Rambo, basically. Right.
You could tell they were going to keep taking hacks with it. I mean, you know, it's like a prospect with a lot of hype. You're going to keep running him out there at some point because maybe it'll click, you know, and if it clicks, it's going to be great, but it just never clicked.
Right.
More. Yeah.
No, this one failed miserably. It did not work well at all. So your time is 4:56. And when you're talking about matches that you're hoping doesn't lower this grade any lower, we get to this next one, which doesn't help matters either.
Nobody cooks meth like Corporal Kirshner. Yes. Pedro Morales battling Tiger Chung Lee. And the graphic speaks differently because that's called, according to that, Tiger Chun Lee, C-U-H-U-N, no G.
Yes.
So they fucked that up on the graphic. That sets the stage for this barn burner. Morales still completely aimless, as always. We start with a lockup as Ladd talks about Morales being left-handed, as Gorilla talks about his short fuse, that hot Latin blood running through his veins. Morales cracks Tiger with a left hand, but Tiger comes back as Gorilla says he's the master of the martial arts. Tiger keeps kicking and chopping away until Pedro falls through the ropes and onto the announce table. Tiger keeps laying them in, grabbing a near fall, but Pedro cuts him off with an eye rake. Ladd talks about the great Puerto Rican legends and says Antonino Rocca, but clarifies he's not Puerto Rican, but he had a great Puerto Rican partner. Pedro lands a punch to the gut and then knocks Tiger into Gorilla with a left hand. Tiger comes back and Pedro takes over with a backdrop and punches. Pedro dodges a charge and gets a sunset flip for two. Pedro punches Tiger in the gut, gets a small package for the win. Complete, utter waste of time. Nothing going on here. A match just to have a match and nothing else. Just the epitome of just a useless, useless match. I went pure dud on this shit bomb, Scott.
Yeah, this is awful. And you know what, Kelly? I have a question that I want to ask both you guys. So, Kelly, I'll acquiesce and let you do your comments first because I got a question that really burned through me today as I was watching this match. So I'm going to wait. So, Kelly, go ahead, give your comments, and then I have a question for both you guys to kind of go with my comments. So go ahead.
Okay. Well, I did give this a half star because it was short.
3:52.
Yeah, very short. You know, we've seen some long Pedro matches that get pretty aimless. Tiger Chung Lee, I have a soft spot for him. I always will. So remember, he had to face Ted Arcidi in Ted's first terrible match. So, God, the guy deserves a break. So I thought he showed Tiger Chung Lee showed some good intensity at the start, you know, slugging away with Pedro coming in. And then, it was super quick. But it didn't last long enough to the point where I was bored. So that's why I didn't give it a dud.
Yeah, the match is not good. And I like Tiger Chun Lee. 352 your time. All right. I'm thinking about this today. Pedro Morales, historically, and I know you guys kind of trash him on and off during the Titans run, Kel.
Mm-hmm.
But Pedro is one of the greatest in the history of the business, even to this point. The first Triple Crown winner in history. I mean, he should be at the level that Bruno is at. I mean, he was just as many huge matches at the Garden as Bruno had in the 70s.
Yeah.
He's been world champion, intercontinental champion, tag champion, first Triple Crown champion in history. So the question is, why is Bruno so revered, even if by 1986, yet Pedro is just another trash bag beating up shitty jobbers? Like, why do you think the company, or why do you think Pedro doesn't have that same reverence that Bruno has? When, well, I shouldn't say his resume is better. Obviously, Bruno speaks for himself. Maybe if you do number of title reigns, but again, you're talking about a guy with the belt for 9 years or 8 years. But why is it that Pedro is just treated like, oh, he's a guy that used to wrestle really good in the 70s, and Bruno is da Brun? Like, was it something internal, Kel, you think? Or, and Jay, your opinion as well, because I know a huge Pedro fan you are. What is it? Why is Pedro kind of get treated like just another guy when, really, in the last 15 years, going back to 70, 71, he is in that rarefied air? What do you think it is, Kel?
Well, and this is just a guess. I'm thinking, you know, Bruno was more financially secure and, of course, a bigger legend in New York. I think Pedro probably didn't have, you know, fuck you money, to use a modern phrase. Like, he needed the payday. So he was kind of at the mercy of Vince, basically. I mean, he was still winning all of his matches. But yes, they were all of the lower card variety. Yeah, I mean, he did have the tag match with Tito against the Dream Team. And I know he has a few more bright spots coming up. But he wasn't being jobbed out yet. But he definitely wasn't being treated as a big deal in MSG. Maybe the makeup of the audience had changed too. I'm not sure. With the Puerto Rico contingency fans for Pedro. I'm not sure if it was still as heavy as it once was. Mm-hmm. But I think part of it definitely was that Pedro was a little bit more, you know, he needed Vince more than Bruno needed Vince, I think, at this point in his life.
So you're thinking it's strictly a wallet thing?
That's my just pure guess. I have no evidence to back that up.
What do you think, JR? What do you think? I know we, you know, Pedro's matches have been a little, you know, subpar, but even just the commentary, like, I mean, Gorilla talks highly of him, but not like the way they talk about Bruno. You know what I mean?
Yeah. And the money thing makes sense to me. Yeah, I'm not sure why they don't revere him that way. Yeah, I don't know. Honestly, I don't have much of an answer for it. Maybe it was a drawing thing. I mean, I've never really gone back and looked at the books to see how much I know Pedro had a good run, but was Bruno that much more successful? Probably. And he just, whatever. I mean, it could be as simple as Vince had a soft spot for Bruno. Pedro was his dad's guy and he didn't really give a shit. You know what I mean? Like, I mean, it could be something like that.
That's true.
You know, who knows with Vince? But yeah, I mean, I'm guessing Pedro's out there jobbing because he probably needs some cash.
It's something to think about, and I think that's what it was too. I think you're right. I think Bruno was in better shape.
Right. I mean, Pedro could have just loved fucking wrestling. I mean, he could have like not cared and just been like, I don't care. I just want to go out and have the rush and whatever. If they'll grant me the ability to have 9-minute matches across the country, I want to milk it for a couple more years. So I mean, it could be that too. He just like doing.
Good point. True. I'm surprised they didn't kind of do a. Would have been neat to do maybe like a Legends thing, like a Bruno Pedro tag team.
That'd be
really neat. I'm surprised they didn't think about doing that on the circuit. How about Pedro Bruno against like Piper Savage or something? That'd be pretty cool. They give Pedro a rub that he probably could use.
Yeah.
And you know, Bruno could finally face somebody that maybe he trusts. I don't know. It was just something I thought about today as I was watching this match. Like, why do they treat Pedro like just another guy while you know, Bruno's da Brun, you know? I don't know. It's just something to think about. But the match
is interesting. No, it is something that should be explored somehow. I don't know how we would do it exactly. Maybe well, Pedro Morales is still alive. We could
get him on the show.
Work out. Yeah, get him and Bruno on.
Why do they treat you like shit, Pedro? Tell us.
That'd be a good table for three. Pedro, yeah. Bruno, I don't know.
AJ Styles. It seems like they throw him in these random ones.
Random new guys kind of glue the. Yeah,
all right, let's go. We still got two matches to talk about here. Good talking point, though, Scott. Jake Roberts is back, taking on our boy, Scott McGee. Jake working his way up the ladder with another match here in MSG. McGee hasn't been around as much, but as always, he's solid. Ladd is still hooked on Rock as tag partner, offering up his trivia, which Al says he loves. And I just call back to TNT in the trivia contest. Al, I love trivia. Warm little reception for McGee, and not much of anything for Jake. We get some talk about the snake in the bag as we get underway. Jake punches away as Ladd tells us both guys are second-generation wrestlers. Jake is super aggressive, moving around quickly and shooting McGee hard into the corner before crushing him with a gut breaker. Ladd asks Gorilla to answer the question, and he does. It's Miguel Perez, who Gorilla says now has a son that wrestles. Miguel Perez Jr., of course. McGee comes back with a dropkick and a pair of suplexes for two. Jake bails outside. He comes back in, and McGee is all over him, grabbing a near fall. Gorilla works in an occipital protuberance reference. I think it's one of our first we've had from him. As Roberts dodges a knee drop and follows a hard clothesline, McGee recovers, but in a blink, Jake hits that DDT for the win. After the match, Jake unleashes Damien on McGee, which is quite the spectacle at this point. A fine match, basically a squash, a slight bump for the aggression in the finish, and Jake is rolling and really making his presence known here in the early going. Kelly, what did you think of this one?
Yeah, I thought it was a great showcase for Jake.
I went half a star, by the way.
So. Okay. I went a full star just because it did what it had to do to make Jake look great. It wasn't too terribly long. Jake, you know, got all his offense in. I loved the out-of-nowhere DDT.
Mm-hmm.
That was cool. And, yeah, I love Jake Roberts. So, I mean, anything with him in it, usually I'll rate somewhat highly. So, yeah, one star.
Were you excited about the trivia?
Yeah.
I do think it was timely because I watched this, I think, the day that Miguel Perez got nominated in the Greatest Wrestler, WWE Wrestler Ever project. So.
Right. I was just going to say, I think I was the second for Perez or maybe even the third. That got him nominated. There's not much footage out there, unfortunately. But the clips that I did watch recently, I mean, he looked like he was a pretty, you know, fast-paced kind of guy with high spots, a lot of drop kicks for the time. I think he was definitely a better worker than his partner, Argentino Rocca.
Mm-hmm.
Who knows? We'll see.
I love how into it Ladd was with the kept like talking about across two matches.
Mm-hmm.
All right, Scott, what'd you think?
I gave it a star. I thought that right now it's the perfect kind of match for Jake. Just get a little bit of stuff in, and then snap the DDT off. I don't think this is bad for Scott McGee because this is his role, so it's fine. Once again, point number two about how idiotic these announcers are, Gorilla and Alfred are. Anytime there's shenanigans after a match, if the babyface does the shenanigans to the heel and like Jesse bitches or even Bobby, Gorilla will go, well, hey, it's after the match. Anything goes. The match is over. But when a heel is doing something wrong to a babyface, Gorilla's like, why isn't the referee stopping this? It's once again, it's just, and I don't know, I'm taking the 2017 thinking watching 1986. I understand that. It still needs to be said, though, because again, it really does get ludicrous at one point. And Ernie is still Ernie, and he's pretty funny. But Jake is definitely on the fast track, and the matches are just looking really good for him because this one was 407, and that's a perfect length for Jake right now because all you want to do is see him snap the DDT off and end it.
Mm-hmm.
So it's perfect length, nothing crazy. We don't need to deal with, you know, we know Jake is probably a good worker and he'll get to that point in feuds where he's going to have to work 9, 10, 11 minutes, and that's fine. But this is good now for a jobber, 407, get it done, snap the DDT, put Damien around the guy's neck, have him spit up, you know, drool like George Wells, and move on to the next match. Perfectly fine for Jake right now. He's got plenty of time. So glad they didn't waste anything you know, waste any more time making this match longer than it needed to be. Which brings us, JR, speaking of time, to our main event.
It is, and the return of Hulk Hogan to Madison Square Garden, teaming up with Hillbilly Jim, his old buddy, taking on Big John Studd and King Kong Bundy. Bundy and Hogan, of course, still simmering from WrestleMania. Pretty big main event here. Crowd is buzzing. Bobby brings out his boys. They get more fired up when Real American starts to play, and Hogan and Hillbilly come storming out. A good way to keep Hogan and Bundy boiling, like I said, inserting Hillbilly into the picture as well. Al says Hulk is devoted to his fans and wrestling, and Ladd says Bundy better watch out. Gorilla talks about how it seems like just yesterday Hulk pulled Jim out of the crowd to train him, and Al said it may be the biggest success story of the last decade. Quite the heaping praise on Hillbilly. Jim and Stud start things off. Gorilla already knows the ref has no chance to keep order. Jim blocks a blow and lays in some punches and headbutts and nearly slams Stud, but couldn't get him over all the way over. Stud hammers away, slams Hillbilly. Hillbilly tags in Hogan, but Stud meets him with some big hammer blows and runs him into the buckle before slamming him easily. Ladd talks about Hogan's golden tan as he crawls around the ring, trying to catch his breath. Hogan ducks a clothesline and slams Stud with ease to a huge pop, and Gorilla says he just earned $15,000. Bundy then comes in, and Hogan slams him, and the crowd's just going bananas. Heenan hops on the apron and gets whacked, and he regroups with his crew as Hogan and Jim celebrate, and the crowd goes wild. Al says Hulk is possibly the first ever to slam Stud, because Stud denies that Andre ever did it. It's like the oddest fucking thing ever since we all saw it at WrestleMania. I don't know why Al was like, well, Stud says he didn't do it. Stud comes back in, and he and Hulk lock up. Stud backs him into the corner. Hogan tries to slam Stud again, but he can't, and Stud lays into his back and shoves him into Bundy. Bundy tags in and drops a hard forearm to the face and kicks away. Gorilla says Bundy's well over 500 pounds as he continues to work over the champ, focusing on the lower back. Stud comes in with a double axe off the second rope and hooks in a bear hug. Hogan fights out of it. Stud mows him down and tags in Bundy, who comes in empty with an elbow drop. Hogan tags in Jim, who comes in hot, working over Bundy with a flurry. Bundy then levels Jim with a clothesline and a knee drop, but Jim kicks out of the cover. Bundy overpowers Jim with strikes and then tags in Stud, who keeps the pressure on. Stud grabs a bear hug, but Jim breaks free and tags Hulk, who comes in and takes it right to Stud with a clothesline and chops. Hogan lands the big boot and then finally gets Stud down with an atomic drop. Jim ties up Bundy as Hogan drops the leg, but Heenan breaks up the pin to draw the DQ. After the bell, Bundy tries to avalanche Jim, but in an amazing, amazing, fantastically timed spot, Jim jumps out of the corner, and Hogan whips Heenan into the corner, and he takes the avalanche. The timing, it has to be seen. I believe Alan underscore Cheapshot on Twitter actually gifted this a while ago, maybe a few weeks ago, and it was fantastic then. So if you're looking at it, you can check his Twitter timeline or check out this match, because it's awesome the way they do it. Heenan and crew bail as Hogan and Jim celebrate. Fun main event, great heat, wasn't too long. The slam spots were really good. I loved Hogan, slamming him back to back, and then they kind of paused to soak it in. It was like it's like when a hitter hits like his 500th home run or something, and they all stop to like honor him. Like the match stops, so Hogan could celebrate winning the 5th.
Yeah.
Better spot for Jim, obviously, here than being Uncle Elmer's fucking lackey. Hogan's still the man, of course, as always. I went 2.5 on this, Scott.
I went 2. It was okay. I could have sworn at this point, though, that Hogan was wearing the red and yellow permanently. I didn't realize he was still wearing some of his AWA alternate gear, wearing all white. The match was fine. I mean, it wasn't exactly the colossal jostle. We only had one half of the it was just the colossal. Mm. There wasn't any jostling. Point number three. Why are we denying one of the tri-main events of WrestleMania 1, and Alfred just totally no-sold it? No sense whatsoever. None. In that building, no sense at all. Was really Hogan had to be put over that much that we just erase history? No sense at all. And I think I'd like to think this finally ends the $15,000 body slam storyline, like we don't have to deal with this gimmick anymore. And then we move on. So I'm fine with that. I think that was part of that as well. It was kind of a plodding match. It was methodical. It went slow. Expecting these guys that are in this match to be that slow. It was nice to have Hogan back. Also probably putting a bow on the Bundy feud. You know, just 15 days earlier, he beat him in the cage, and now here he is back, kind of finishing it off again. I am puzzled by the DQ finish. Why didn't it just end clean? What are we continuing here? I mean, he already slammed him. He already beat Bundy solo in the big stage. Why is this ending in a DQ? I don't get it. Made no sense to me. Somebody should have just pinned somebody clean and moved on. Hogan might as well just make Bundy eat it again and just moved on. That one kind of perplexed me. So I give it 2 stars. It was a decent final match of the night, but nothing earth-shattering or world-beating. Kel?
I thought this was a really good match. Specifically, I thought this was like a really, really good Hogan performance where he's like pulling a hammer here and working like 90% of the match for his team. Mm-hmm. And really, he is the workhorse of the match with all 4 guys. This is Hogan, Hogan broomstick performance in a way. It really, I'd seen this match before, but watching it this time, I really appreciated what Hogan did in this one. He was the glue who kept it all together, and he worked his ass off in this match.
He did.
The crowd, of course, like you said, JR, lost its shit for this, because this is a huge main event for the time period. All big names. And Hogan and Bundy, fresh off WrestleMania 2, of course. I thought the back-to-back slam spot was great. Of course, that's, you know, detractors of Hogan would say that was like a glory hog moment. Nah, maybe it was.
Fuck that. Yeah, maybe a year ago, but both Bundy and Studd at this point are, I mean, we've seen it. They're done. Yeah, I mean, like, whatever. Who cares at this point? It was a great spot. If you're doing this around WrestleMania one time when both guys are kind of hotter, then I could see it. But fuck it. I mean, no. We've seen worse from Hogan. This is nothing. This was awesome. I mean, the crowd loved it.
Yeah, exactly. It was a great spot. This is just like a great example of Hogan being a great worker, actually, because he had to carry this match, and it's something he doesn't get credit for. I think, you know, more people should see this match as an example of Hogan's greatness, because it was impressive to me. I like the finish too, because, you know, the Heenan came out of nowhere on the interference. I totally thought that it was going to be the pin on Stud and it was over, because they set up the big boot leg drop. You know, you're just conditioned to believe that's the end, but Heenan came out. I think Scott, you know, they dragged this out because just for, you know, in those days they would drag these things out because they had all the house shows they still had to do. They had to keep these guys somewhat credible. They milked programs forever. They would blow things off, but they would milk it until there was nothing left. And there was still, you know, Hogan and Bundy, I think, still had some gas in the tank, even though, you know, they had the definitive finish at Mania, but they would do that. I know they came to Calgary in July that year and did Hogan and Bundy. So they were still doing that for a while. I thought this was great fun. I gave it 3 stars.
All right, and that puts a wrap on the show itself, of course, but there's always time for some awards, so why don't we go ahead and wrap up with that. Match of the night, it was tough for me. I had a couple hovering around the same spot, but I did go with Santana Savage. I think even though I rated it the same as Davey and Valentine, if we had the quarter thing going, it probably would have edged out over that. So I went Savage and Santana. You guys both agree?
Yes.
Okay. Yep.
All right, the Cousin Jr. for the worst match of the night, I went with Pedro and Tiger. I just thought it was aimless. I thought it was pointless. It had nothing to it. It was just, you know, and normally it's sometimes I'll give those matches a pass because they're not offensive, but this one just really sucked. I don't know. And no other way to say it. What'd you think, Scott?
Christerton and Tonga was pretty atrocious. He might as well call himself Christerton and be I'm going to split it. I think we got to split the vote on this because they were both pretty awful. So I'll go with Tonga and Christy.
Okay. Cal?
Yeah, I'm going with Tonga and Christy.
Okay.
Guys, although Pedro was pretty...
Tiger Chung pretty wonks. All right, whatever.
Tiger Chun wonks.
All right. What do we got next? We have our MVP of the night. I went with Hulk Hogan. I thought he was the best on the night. I thought he stood out the most. And like you said, Kelly, was an all-time performance for him, just completely carrying everyone out there.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, that's who I went with, too. Third straight for me for Hogan for MVPs.
I was torn because I actually didn't think Hogan. I was like half Savage, half Hammer, but I'll give it to Hogan. Okay. I'll go with you guys on that one because he was pretty awesome in the main event. As much as the match was kind of mediocre, I'll give him props for it.
All right, the Steve Gatewolf Award, which is in jeopardy, being renamed here very soon. I went with usual Steviaffi for this one.
Oh, definitely, no doubt.
Yep, me too.
All right, but because Scott and Pete went with fucking George Wells, Offie's only won 1.5 times, so we can't rename it yet. Our CD's also in the running here. If we get one more CD, we can probably change it. Best moment of the night, I went with Hogan's slamming of Stud and Bundy. I thought that was the best moment. Scott.
I think Valentine pinning to Davey Boy was a great moment because I didn't see it coming, but I'll take the double slam because I think it finally ends that gimmick.
Yeah, I went with the back-to-back slams, too.
All right, our Junior Mr. Universe Award. Hard not to go with them British Bulldogs. what'd you guys think? Kelly?
Hogan was looking pretty geeked, but... yeah, I mean... Anytime you see Dynamite, he's usually busting out of his skin, so I'll go with the Bulldogs.
Kelly?
I went with Hogan. I mean, he was looking especially bronzed also.
You know why? Because of the white tights.
Yes.
The contrast, Kel. The contrast.
So that gives me that Hogan gets a triple crown from me with MVP, best moment in Junior Mr. Universe tonight.
There you go. All right. Overall grade out of 10, Kelly. What'd you have this thing at?
I have it at a 5 out of 10. I rated the previous two MSG shows that I saw with you guys higher. It's been a good year so far. Mm-hmm. I mean, it's been a lot better than 1985. But, I mean, there was a lot of Drek at the beginning. There was some other Drek in the middle. Savage and Santana was awesome. The main event was good. Maybe, I don't know. Maybe 5's too low, but that's what I'm going with.
I'm going with 5 as well. I mean, they didn't have that match. I mean, it was for you more maybe because of how highly you rated Savage Tito, but for me, there was nothing that carried the night. Like, to get it over 5, I need that really, really good match. And we had very, you know, good matches. We didn't have that 4-star and up match in my eyes. And then the Drek was Drek. And the main event, while it was fun, to me wasn't enough to prop the show, even though the crowd was super into Hogan. So I think 5... The way the show was shaping up to me, 5 is actually a pretty good grade when you look at how things shook out compared to how it started.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I gave this a 5 as well because at face value, you have to even out the duds with something really high rated. We had two stinkers, and they were really big stinkers. And if Savage Tito could have been pushed a little higher, and maybe I could have got another 0.5-star out of the main event. I maybe would have given it 5.5, but I'm going to leave it right down the middle and go 5 out of 10 with you guys.
All right. So that'll do it. A couple of bookkeeping notes, of course. We talked about it extensively last week, but the PTBN Greatest WWE Wrestler Ever Project is hot and heavy right now. We have a Facebook group page that all the discussion is happening in. Of course, we have a Google Doc as well with the rules, so if you're not into Facebook but you want to still play along, you can do that. Anybody can submit a list, and lists will not be due till the end of the year because we want everyone to take their time, do your research, have your debates, have your conversations. It's a lot of fun. We're up well over 100 people right now in that group, so if you're interested in something like that, basically you'd be submitting a list of the 100 top wrestlers of all time, factoring in only their WWEF work. And that's all you can consider. So it should be a lot of fun. If you're interested, just check us out on social media or go to PlayStation.com and search Greatest WWE Wrestler. Or just reach out to us as well on Facebook or Twitter, and we can get you signed up for the group. Twitter's place number 2, B Nation. Facebook.com/PlayStation. Amazon, of course, shop with us at PlayStation.com/Amazon. Subscribe to our iTunes feeds, Pro Wrestling Only, PlayStation Nation Wrestling, PlayStation Nation Pop. What else we got here? Instagram, Tumblr, of course. Check out our brand new ebook, our Vintage Vault Refresh series. We're 1994 or 93 Raw. 94 is coming as well in ebook form. Yep. Links are right on the side of the page there. New Jeff Learns Wrestling episode dropped yesterday, so check that out if you've been following that series. I'm walking my buddy Jeff through becoming a wrestling fan chronologically, and this was his indoctrination to the NWA. So we did some 1985-86 NWA matches. So he had some interesting thoughts, including things on Magnum TA's penis. So be sure to listen to that. What else? Letters from Center Stage, of course, each and every Friday morning. Out there for everyone, me and Alan doing a look back at the fun and nostalgia of WCW. New one will be out this week. Scott, we have a main event coming anytime soon, next week?
Next week, yes. Next week, because of schedules, it'll be actually recording on Thursday next week. Obviously, be myself, Brother Nate, and Greeny. We'll preview Money in the Bank, and I know we got some overseas wrestling to discuss, so we'll definitely have a guest on to talk about that, and I think Slammiversary might be around the corner too. So, a lot to talk about. That'll be recording next Thursday on PlaceBeNation.com.
And we are off next week. Like you said, scheduling quirks. Of course, it is the Sword and Shield Classic next Monday. If you haven't donated to that, still available on PlaceBeNation.com.
Yes.
So we'll be back in 2 weeks' time, and I believe that'll just be us, Scott, right? Because we got Saturday night's main event. From May 3rd, and then we'll be back the week after with a run of house shows. We have four in a row coming.
Four in a row, baby.
So a lot of fun there. We'll shake that out. So again, we're off next week. Enjoy the break. Check out all the other shows we have to offer. And otherwise, we'll talk to you 2 weeks from last night on Monday, the 19th. Science Fair event for May of 86. Until then, everyone take care. See you. All about, but I'm having doubts, cause I see you trying to play me out. And when I brought my car to crib with me, didn't I represent you when I caught him in the streets? So let me get the keys to the Lex, and all my checks, and all my hang up, a catcher on your neck, babe.